We're going to go ahead and start out. Ladies and gentlemen, it is, let's see, I'm going to start in 3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pro Photo Show. It's Tuesday, September 13th, 2011. Welcome to episode number 80, our second ever live episode. We've had a few technical glitches and things like that getting started, but we're ready to roll now. We're going to jump right in. We got some cool topics, maybe even a few lightning rounds, and let's do this.
Pausing for effect.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
All right, everybody, we are here and we are live. I've got my old buddy Dennis Zerwas from over in Minnesota. Hello, Dennis.
Hey, Gavin. Thanks for having me, as always.
Yes, indeed. And I have got Mr. Barry Howell, also from Minnesota. Hello, Barry. Good to have you on board.
Glad to be here. I'm old school by phone.
All right. Old school by phone. And you know what? That actually segued really well, because just as I got to introducing you, you showed up and I unmuted you, and I was going to have to say, I was actually going to ask you, Dennis, to give me a Barry voice and try and get this in here, but he just showed up right there and it just worked. And last but not least, Mr. Matt Schumite from Spokane, Washington, just a couple hours away from me. Hello, Matt. Good to have you on board.
Good to be here, Gavin.
Barry got kicked out.
Okay, well, we're just gonna keep rolling. If people are kind of flying in and out here and there, that's cool. It's a live show. We'll just work with it. Dennis is still here, so we'll do what we can. What's new in the news, Dennis? You seen anything really exciting lately? I want to cover a few news topics, and then hopefully by then our panel is going to be rounded off, and we're going to have some fun with some lightning rounds. But have you seen anything that really is exciting?
Not yet. I've seen just a lot of rumors, a lot of buzz for some October announcements on a couple of different fronts. But other than that, rumors are just rumors. But I haven't seen too much. But then again, I don't have my finger on the pulse of the photo news this time of year. This time of year is more just in sitting in front of Lightroom and Photoshop, or have a camera in hand. So what have you seen? Anything?
Trying to get the work done. You know, it does seem like there's a lot of rumors. That seems to be the way of it. It really feels like we're due for some new cameras here. I mean, we've been riding this wave of the whole 5D Mark II, D3X generation for a while. And
yeah.
It's not so cutting edge anymore, is it? I mean, it's great stuff, but you know, aren't we ready for some new stuff? Barry, what do you say? You got any thoughts on this?
All I saw today was a heading that said the official word is that neither Nikon or Canon will have anything new until sometime in 2012.
Really? Where did you see that?
I don't remember. Floating around somewhere between sessions this afternoon.
Interesting.
Just, you know, I just don't think on the DSLR front there's anything significant on the horizon. They're pumping out point-shoot cameras like guppies right now, but boy, oh boy. On the pro side, I think she's going to be a little thin for a while.
I don't know. It seems like they better get with it, because the point and shoots, it seems to me more people are buying SLRs than point and shoots. It seems like you either have an iPhone or, you know, you have a smartphone for your point and shoot. And then if you're really into it and you care about doing better photos, even if you're an amateur, you go out and buy an SLR or a Micro Four Thirds or something like that. That seems to be the trend in photography. But maybe I'm wrong in that. I have heard, was it you, Barry, on the last show that said your friend at Costco said they way outsell point and shoots with SLRs?
Yep. So, at least in a couple of our local locations here in the Twin Cities. I just was in there again yesterday, and they were wheeling out another cart of D5100s, and they must have had 30 of them on this pallet.
Wow.
And he said, those 30 cameras, he says, will be gone midweek.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Know,
so we'll see. I've heard some rumors that they're about to come out with a 5D Mark III, but, you know, rumors are rumors, so let's make sure we know where we're at with that.
Let me ask this, and you know, throw this up for discussion. Realistically, you know, is there enough of a market left to consider on the higher end of the enthusiast bracket? Are there enough buyers left to even really aggressively pursue the higher end cameras, or is the prosumer line of DSLRs simply good enough based on the large and ever increasing market of pseudo amateur and late hobbyists and advancing hobbyists? I don't know.
Well, I think that's kind of their issue, is that cameras are good enough now that unless you're fanatical like me and making big prints and things like that, I mean, they're really doing pretty good stuff. Not that there's no room for improvement, but I think they might be hitting some brick walls in terms of more megapixels and things like that. And I think if they want people to keep buying new cameras, they're really going to have to give us something that offers more. They've kind of gotten themselves, it seems, into a position where, you know, you take Canon and Nikon, business has been skyrocketing, it seems like, over the past few years. They've probably been in hog heaven selling all these cameras, because back in the film days, they didn't resell somebody a camera every 2 years. It was like somebody bought a camera and they used it for years and years and years. But now that they've got a dependency on that kind of revenue stream, that kind of constancy, I'm wondering if they're starting to get a little concerned about where that's going to go. Is that market going to dry up? Matt, I think you're on there. What do you think about all this?
I am, and I'm coming from a little different. I was waiting for Nikon to announce something new, just to kind of. I've been shooting with the Nikon D3 for the past year and a half or so, and I was hoping that I would hear something about a D4 or a D800 to either push me in that direction, or hopefully the D3S prices would drop. And since it looks like absolutely nothing is happening on that front, I went last week and picked up a D3S, so that's my camera. So I moved my D3 to backup mode, and I pretty much am excited when I log into the rumor sites and they say nothing new now, because usually the way it goes with technology is you get something new and then they announce it the next day. So yeah. I'm on board with them leaving it alone for a little while. And I think my understanding, maybe speculation, but that the pro cameras are almost a lost leader, that they're a status symbol for the camera makers and not really their heavy money makers. So that's why.
I was just going to say, take a look at, I put a link in the chat room there for just right off of Wikipedia with the Nikon timeline range of their cameras, and take a look at how often they are refreshing and putting out new models of their consumer mid-range and entry levels compared to, if you look at the very top, it's got their flagship and professionals. I mean, that that line for that D700, this kind of exactly echoes what Barry just said. That D700 line is getting pretty long. You know, it's almost been, it'll be just over three years now that's been in that camera. And I think that's a sweet spot. But like Matt just said, there's just, I mean, why bother? It's a status thing, you know, when they can switch out and get these new entry level and mid ranges into the enthusiast hands. That's where their money is right now. That's their bread and butter.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see where all this goes. And Pinspree has been mentioning the, I think it was Pinspree.
Yeah,
was it you that mentioned the Nikon or Guest 15 also, the Nikon mirrorless cameras. And, you know, that seems to be kind of in the Micro Four Thirds line, the whole rangefinder kind of category, as it were, which admittedly is interesting. I'm glad to see they're getting some bigger sensors and some more compact cameras. I think we talked about this on the last show. I think that's going to be a growing market, too, because it kind of appeals to the, you know, the fashion kind of cool point and shoot, but also at the same time appeals to the pro that wants something that produces quality that's still at a reasonable size. So I think there's some potential there as well. And I guess we'll see where that goes. But any other thoughts? I did link this Samsung NEX-10. No, not an NEX-10. It was the Samsung, is it the 200, I believe it was? Yeah, the NX-200 from Samsung, which is not out yet. They announced it. And this is interchangeable lens, kind of a compact sort of-ish body, but it's 20.3 megapixels on a full APS-C sensor. So it looks not small like a compact, but smaller than, you know, our 5D Mark II for sure, that kind of thing. So that could be an interesting line. Again, kind of in that Micro Four Thirds compact, but serious level of camera, and it's going to run in at about $1,000. So that's actually quite a few megapixels for a camera that small, and it supposedly goes up to ISO 12,000. So maybe Pinspree, that'll give you that ISO 3200.
It is interesting to see how people are making the jump from just regular, you know, consumers who have a camera are making the jump from these point and shoots, and then they feel like it doesn't provide enough, and then they end up going to these, big and bulky, at least big and bulkier entry level DSLRs compared to their little point and shoots, and then how many of them just bypass, you know, this kind of camera or like or the P7000 or the Canon comparable model, they just bypass those thinking that they don't have the chops, or, you know, are just, they think they're getting another point and shoot. So it's like, how many of them actually loop back around to something, a higher end camera,
yeah,
like the Samsung? That's pretty slick looking.
But ultimately, if they don't think that they really need it and they don't see the value, they look at that pretty attractive price of some kit camera or just a, you know, a kind of a mid to upper end prosumer type body, and they look at the specs and they scratch their head and they go, boy, that extra $800,000, $1,200, $1,500 is just not worth it. I'll buy another zoom lens and I'm good to go. I just don't really need the quality. I'm not going to make 40-inch prints. I just think there's a real defection of quality, not to mention the fact, you know, so few people print anything anymore. It's all, how good does it look on my screen? How good does it look on my Facebook gallery?
Well, and that's the thing is like, if they're basing it on that, the problem is a lot of people are buying new cameras just because it's a new gadget. They're not even beginning to scratch what these cameras can do. I guess what it comes down to at that point is they got to add enough gimmicks to get somebody to buy a new camera. It's not necessarily about giving us professionals something that's going to help us, although usually I suppose it probably would. It just seems like – I have no idea what I'm saying. Never mind.
Well, I think if I could interject here.
Yeah,
let me save you, Gavin.
I kind of lost it there.
let me save you here, Gavin. I think – when it comes to consumer electronics, especially, people buy what's in front of them. And I think it's Costco. I think when they go to Costco, they look at they know they want a decent camera, and they look at the point and shoot that's $400 or $500, and they take the look to the right and see the digital SLR, the Rebel,
yeah,
or whatever it is, and they see that it's $50 more, and they don't know the difference. They just know that it looks closer to what a professional would use, and so they make the decision to do that, when in reality, they're not making a decision, an informed decision. They're just choosing what's in front of them, and then, you know, then they expect it to do all of these wonderful things, and then they end up getting the same pictures they probably would get with a point-and-shoot anyway.
Because they can't really take advantage of all the features that this thing produces.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody else in there mentioned the Sony Alpha 77. And, you know, there's another person that just, you know, another DSLR, but it does look like a pretty cool one. And Sony does seem to be trying to get some oomph in there in terms of their SLRs as well. So sometimes it seems like in these DSLRs from Canon and Nikon and things like that, they inch out features so slowly, as if, you know, because there's just not that much competition. I mean, maybe if they want us to buy new cameras, they need to do things like built-in RF wireless that actually works all the time. I mean, you know, the kind of stuff that would really make us a serious enthusiast and professional photographers that would give us an edge. I mean, yes, I would be all for 50 or 60 megapixels, although that's probably not what most people need. But I think they're going to have to get some new features out there. And I don't know, maybe there's a little bit of a pause right now as they try and figure out what they can offer to sell a new body. How do they trump the 5D Mark II enough, or the Mark IV, or the D3S, or something like that, enough to make people want to go out and buy all over again? With that, just move on here. I got a couple more links.
Does anybody know if Sony is still, are they still working on this latest camera, the vibration reduction built into the body as opposed to the lenses, a la Canon and Nikon? Still, is Sony still pushing the Steadicam technology on the body? Somebody said, Pinsbury says yes, they are. All right, Pinsbury, I'm believing.
Yeah.
Kind of makes some sense.
It does make sense. And again, that seems like one of those features that Canon and Nikon could add too. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think Canon and Nikon are pathetically slow at releasing features, because I think they found that they can be. You know, for years now, they've been releasing new cameras and say, hey, look, it has new ISO, it has this or that. And it's really not that many new features. It's just enough, particularly in image quality, that we've been saying, wow, I want a new camera. Now that the image quality is getting really good, maybe they're actually going to have to start putting out some effort to give some, you know, a wider plethora of new features when a camera comes out. I mean, admittedly, they've been introducing video and this and that. I mean, they've been coming out with cool stuff. But sometimes the third world brands, as it were, you know, the non-mainstream SLR bodies get some really cool features. You know, the Pentaxes and the Sonys and stuff like that, they introduce some really cool features that you know, we're sitting here saying, hey, why doesn't Canon and Nikon have these? Well, maybe they're going to have to start to get into those a little bit. But I don't know. We'll see.
Gavin, when I used to shoot Olympus, Olympus is one of the companies that first started putting the image stabilization in their cameras. And that was one of the big arguments in favor of Olympus was their lenses were a lot less expensive because they didn't have to put that image stabilization inside their lenses. So each time you bought a new lens, you weren't rebuying that technology, which makes mm-hmm. sense. And maybe that's a reason why Canon and Nikon like to have it in their lenses is because that's another feature they can put in their lenses, and that's probably what they're going to be making most of their money off of anyway.
Right, right. And I hear that Olympus makes – in fact, you're one of the ones that told me Olympus makes a phenomenal body. Another thing you said the Olympus had is that they're incredibly durable, and we don't get that, particularly with the lower-end Canon and Nikons. They're kind of, you know, just cameras.
I had a wave from Puget Sound splash over my Olympus E3 once upon a time, and it kept on going. I have the couple that I was taking pictures of, I have a photo of after the wave came over of them both freaking out because of it, and it still kept right on going. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was great at that. The problem was it was not full frame, and there was no chance that getting full frame. And if I was hitting ISO 800, I had to nail my exposure, and there was no pushing beyond that. So I had to look elsewhere to greener pastures.
Right, right, exactly. Hey, Dennis and Barry and Matt, I'm counting on you guys to kind of watch the chat room as well, because as I'm trying to keep my notes and everything going over here, sometimes I lose track of it. So if you see anything to bring up in there, absolutely do. And for you people in there, Pinspree, I see you putting a lot of stuff in there. If you want to chime in on this, you know, you're welcome to dial in, and we'll pop you on for a couple minutes. And I'm trying to kind of read through everything you're typing to the other chatters, but you're welcome to dial in and give us some thoughts. Another news bit that I found interesting, just posting that in the chat room now, is the iPhone SLR mount. And this allows you to take your Canon or Nikon lens and attach it to your iPhone 4, and it looks absolutely ridiculous, and it's awesome.
Oh, boy.
to quote a good friend of mine, Mr. Dennis Erwas, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
I'm sorry. I have to do a wedding with this.
No, you don't, Gavin.
Here's the thing. You can do this. You don't have to, you know, you can get all this depth of field and cool focus stuff without spending $3 on an app. Instead, you can spend $200 to $250 on this lens adapter and then use your $1,000 lens, which is hanging off the front of your iPhone, which weighs about a tenth of it. And so hopefully you don't rip the front of your iPhone off. You notice in the photo that I linked, in the link there, it shows a photo. You do have to support that ridiculously large lens so that it doesn't rip your iPhone in half. But...
Well, as of right now, there have been more lenses falling off Canon 5D Mark IIs than iPhones. So.
Oh, he did.
Plus one, Barry. No, I mean, but you got to look at the mechanism and stuff. Somebody spent a lot of time. I mean, there's an element of nerdy awesome in this, even though it's like I would get this and totally not use it. But, I mean, come on. This has... Yeah, Photo Jojo, like, you know, they have a tendency to come out with these things that you're kind of like, what, wait, that's awesome.
Well, the first person who shoots a wedding using this will probably get some nice blog action out
exactly.
of it.
Exactly, so. That's what it's about, is you buy a new gadget, you get there first, and then you get a lot of retweets, and yeah, exactly. So we'll see where that goes. The iPhone 4 mount is actually a couple months old story. So maybe some of you out there already have one. Most of you have probably already bought that, and we'll see how that comes out. Show us some photos from that. The problem I have with the iPhone 4 is that at anything over ISO 1, it looks terrible. No, just kidding. It's actually not bad for a phone. It's the best phone camera I've had, put it that way.
Well, judging by the size of the sensor of the iPhone, does that make a 70 to 200, 7,000 to 2 million millimeters?
I'm guessing probably the attachment you put on has some optics in there. Because that would
okay.
be, talk about a telephoto. I mean, right. wide angle, you have to have a 1 millimeter lens. But if you're doing wildlife, you could have this whole new genre of wildlife photographers. It's like, well, yes. there is some suffering in quality, but using a regular 70 to 200 Canon, we can get the equivalent of 7,000 to 20,000 for only $2,000 at f2.8, and that's pretty phenomenal.
Hey, Dennis, hold still. Let me take your picture. Go on your roof.
Okay. This is, what, 1,500 miles away? You should be able to see. You may want to back up a little bit.
That's about right, yeah. Yeah, it'll be a headshot.
Next thing you know, it's going to be like the astronomy magazine. It'll be like on the cover, like, new tech allows us to see further into space than ever before.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that one. That's neat. I mean, that's neat. So don't put a lot of work into that. But if you see, I mean, when you look at the pictures of the people using it, it's kind of like, okay.
Well,
like,
okay. I mean, it's Photo JoJo. They do that quirky stuff. You know, they do things that allow you to point your camera down at the street and take photos of people kind of on the fly, and they can't see you, and, you know, they can't tell you're doing it. Super secret stuff. Just posted another link in the chat area, little link on TechCrunch. And what?
Well, I don't know what I'm going to expect. I just click on these links, and next thing you know, I got
You know what? You guys are welcome to link some stuff in the news. I'm just saying. I mean, I had to pull
it. Well, no, this is fun. I don't have anything. I would just link to the weather.
This is actually pretty awesome.
There we
go. This is a commercial photographer who spent about $500,000 to have a custom 8x10 digital back made, digital sensor. And for a somebody who's kind of been into large format like I have lately, this is pretty awesome, but I would never do it. But this is only 10 megapixels, so basically it's one megapixel per inch, I guess. I have no idea why it's only 10. Maybe it's harder to have a custom-made sensor done than you would think. You'd think with that much surface area, he could have zillions of megapixels, but that might have cost zillions of dollars. So in any case, this is pretty awesome. Basically, his name is Mitchell Feinberg, and if you go to this guy's website, this guy's actually looks like a really good commercial photographer. It looks like he's doing high-end stuff. And what he's doing with this is he uses 8x10 film for this commercial work, and what he's doing is using this now instead of Polaroid. Polaroid film is becoming increasingly hard to get. It's expensive, and he's using this as his Polaroid. He does his test frames on this, and then it's not enough resolution for what he's trying to accomplish, so then once he gets it all set up, he does it on a sheet of 8x10 film. Now, first of all, I'd kind of love to get this guy on to see, like, how is he, you know, he's clearly must be in a pretty high-end market if he's doing commercial work on 8x10 film. I mean, that's pretty awesome. And he's not wanting to back away from that. Apparently, whatever this guy's doing, he's planning on sticking with it because he just invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in a 10-megapixel digital back for his 8x10. So I have to say, this is pretty sweet. And I read, I don't know if the quote frame is on this article, probably it is, but I think what he was saying was, sounds like a lot of money, but okay, it says he was spending $50,000 a year on Polaroids, so he figures this thing's going to pay for itself, and it's pretty interesting. Anybody else, like, is this pretty cool?
Very
good. It'd be fun to see it. I'd love to see it working, see what it does. I just, having lived with the D3 for a while and having no sensor cleaning, I start to twitch a little bit when I see a sensor that big, and imagine how much dust that thing would collect.
Well, even my 5D Mark II sensor, I can't for the life of me keep it completely clean at F22. I'm still working on that, and once I figure it out, there's going to be a really great post on Pro Photo Show constantly buying new gadgets to try and work with it. But although this isn't his final image either, so if this is just his proof images, it's probably not quite as critical if there's a little dust on that sensor. So it's pretty cool, I have to say.
And his photos are amazing.
Yeah, he just kind of really nice. This is not, I mean,
great.
Yeah, this is not somebody that just like, oh, well, I need a digital back for an 8x10. I mean, I think this guy had a real reason to do this. And it's definitely a niche market, but it's pretty cool. I'd love to have a digital back for 4x5 that recorded a couple hundred megapixels, but really the only thing out there that we'll do that as a scan back, which, you know, would give you a lot of megapixels, but it's not the same. It would work for commercial stuff, I guess, but it takes, you know, maybe 5 seconds to 5 minutes to actually record the image. So it's definitely not for sports and action, Barry.
Yeah.
Zach Baker just posted something in here, and I'm looking. I shouldn't have said anything before I left. Oh, that's cool. It's a 4x5 camera made of Lego bricks. And it looks like they actually have a Linhof lens on the front. And that's just the beauty of, like, large format. It's really The concept of the camera is not that complicated. And one of the things I'm loving about large format is that it's not like buying a lens for a Canon or a Nikon. There's tons of large format lenses. Some of them, you know, you might find a great lens, some obscure, weird thing that's 80 years old. But the thing is, you don't have to have a lens that fits your camera, quote. You can adapt it to your board and fit it in the hole and get it set up so it just works. And that's a really cool thing about the large format world, is that you can get that sort of just kind of browse around and find these weird, cool, obscure lenses. And I love it. Other than that, in the news, real quick, I don't think I mentioned this last time, a little bit of an ad, I guess, but the new HDR Magic video workshop on light and tonal range and all that kind of stuff. It's about a two-hour video workshop that I released over on SimFX. That's live now, and you can get all the videos in HD downloadable. Doesn't obviously cover everything I cover in my Lights and Shadows workshops where we got multiple days, but a lot of stuff covered in terms of processing HDR and all the way down to more essential stuff like managing dynamic range, even on single images and channels and processing and things like that. So you might check that out, simfx.com/HDR, and take a peek at that. And what else in the news of Pro Photo Show? The Pro Photo Show forums have been revised, so head over and check that out, profotoshow.net/forum, and totally free. That's our forum community over there. I've redid the forum software, got it updated, redid the design of the forum. We were getting to where we were having a lot of issues with spam and stuff like that. Got all new spam tools and stuff in there, so it's really kind of cleaned up, new boards, everything from working with film to digital workflow to, you know, just talking shop. Pretty much anything that you want to talk about photography is over on the Pro Photo forums at profotoshow.net/forum. So that's kind of a new update for us on Pro Photo Show. Check that out. I hope you guys will join us over there. And with that, let's go into some other cool topics. If anybody else wants to add any thoughts or anything like that right now, feel free to raise your hand. We'll add you in here. Let's start off with a lightning round. And lightning round one, is the photography business dying? Barry, you got your stopwatch out?
I can get it out.
I can grab it here. I'll be honest with
you. Okay, you be
on my own time. Yeah, I'll be an equal opportunity podcaster.
That's probably a good idea, because as Gavin knows from our discussions we have, I'm probably one of the only people that can keep up talk-wise with Gavin. So I'm looking forward to having the stopwatch on me.
High pace like me. In fact, Matt, because we had so many technical issues, everybody knows me and Dennis and Barry. We didn't actually get a chance to officially introduce you. So give us the before we jump into the lightning round, give us the 30-second bio. Tell us where you're at and what you do and all that kind of stuff. Matt Shumate.
Shumate. It's okay.
Shumate. Sorry. Good. God. Hang on. I can edit it. Here we go. Matt. Okay, sorry.
Perfect. Hey, thanks, Gavin, for having me on today. I am based in Spokane, Washington. I'm from the other side of the mountains over Tacoma, Seattle. Moved over here 6 years ago right out of school for a graphic design job. And that's my schooling and background is graphic design. And a couple of years ago, I decided, this doing graphic design all day and all night is getting to be a little much. So I picked up a camera about as cheap as I could find and started taking pictures. And one thing led to another. I had a girl who I'd taken some pictures for at a salon ask me to photograph her wedding. And I told her there's no way I would ever do anything so irresponsible in my whole life. And so I just left it at that, and she called me back and begged, and since she was cute and sweet, and I used to DJ weddings, so I knew a little something about them, I said I would. So I took on a couple of them and found that it is exactly what I want to do.
Awesome.
So I started researching everything I could find, and one of the things I found was the Pro Photo Show. One of my very, very, very first learning experiences, and what I took with me to those first weddings was things that I learned by listening to the podcast. And that was, just that's all I listened to get my information. So it's kind of full circle. And in fact, the only wedding that I second shot ever was with Gavin. Invited me along to an amazing wedding, and I had a blast shooting with him. And that was my fifth wedding, I believe. That was 2 years ago, and last year I shot 30 weddings, and this year I'll get close to 50. So pretty much
crazy.
Weddings. I do a few seniors and a few things, other family things here and there, but if you look at my website, you're pretty much only going to find weddings.
Very cool. Well, and you're one of those photographers, Matt, that's come a long way in a short time, and you know, you do some, you put some nice stuff out there, and that's great. And I have to confess, I well with pride a little bit that we actually have people that, you know, Pro Photo Show's been around long enough that we've got people who are now really going places with their photography that started out listening to Pro Photo Show. I mean, that's just awesome. So.
It is. It absolutely. And one of the things that I love about where our industry is the information is out there. It's no longer based. Your success is no longer based on what school you went to or what equipment you have. It's based on how much effort and what your vision is. And all of those important things are going to determine your success. And so it's, you're not limited by anything anymore the same way as you were 10 years ago. And so it allows things like that to happen. So I'm thankful that there's people out there that put the information out there that allowed me to learn and kind of take it to where I've gone, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Dennis, are you back? I know you were having some audio issues.
Yeah, I'm back. Thank you.
You're very quiet. I'm not sure what happened. Get that mic up there. You must have knocked it out of whack a little bit.
No, I'm still good.
There you go. There you go. Matt was just giving us his bio. I don't know where we lost you, but
I think he said when he was about 6 years old, yeah, he was a boy growing up in Tacoma, Seattle, and then I came back and he said he loved the show. So we're good.
In any case, good to have you back.
Hey,
super.
You know, the front of my brochure is a photo I took on that second shot, or when I second shot that wedding with Gavin. So.
Yeah, that was a fun day too.
It sure was.
It was cool. Anyway, yeah, it's nice I don't get people on very often that are right in my backyard almost. Well, 2 hours away, but when you live in this part of the country, that's
enough.
Your backyard. Yeah, exactly. This isn't the urban metropolis. All right, so moving on from that, let's jump into our lightning rounds. Barry, are you still with us? You're awful silent.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, excellent.
I'm just in amazement of the, you know, 30 to 50 wedding a year concept. I think I'm going to pack up shop and go move out to your neck of the woods.
Matt's really doing good getting those in. I confess I don't want that many, but I really admire the fact that that people can get out there and keep grooving and putting out that quality on that kind of volume. That's pretty impressive.
And Matt, what kind of price value is going on in your market? I mean, is there
good
kind
question.
Of a garden spot of wedding package booking levels? I mean, how much are people realistically spending in your part of the world?
I think I'm pretty average right now, maybe a little bit above average. It's probably similar as to other places. There's a few high end, but the high end aren't much more than me. I'm averaging about 3,000, so I tend to be on the high end. And then there's a lot of photographers in the 1,500 range. So I'm staying busy, very busy, but it's not as good as it probably was, but I'm able to pay a mortgage and take care of three kids by shooting weddings. So far, so good.
Excellent.
Great.
Very cool. Okay. Well, on that note, let's go into this topic of that's probably a little controversial, but I just want to get some different opinions. And that is the photography business dying? So each panelist is going to have 2 minutes on this to give their thoughts on where they think we kind of stand and what's coming, and, you know, kind of get your little prophecy thrown in there for where the future of photography is going. So with that, we will start. I'll go last since I suggested the topic. And the question is the photography business dying? Let's start with you, Matt, since you're new here and you've got 2 minutes. I'll give you the buzzer when you're getting close.
Okay. So is photography dying? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay,
business,
on my mark, get set, go. I think it's not dying, but I think it's more difficult. I think the competition is higher. I think people that have got lax in what they do and what they create have things to complain about. I don't think that there's I think the need is still there. I think I was listening to a guy who does a comedy show, and he sounds brilliant. The stories he tells are brilliant. And then he had a call-in session where people would tell their stories, and they sounded awful. And all it did was make me recognize the difference between what a skilled person does and what a non-skilled person does. And I think even though there's more photographers clamoring for eyes on Facebook and places like that, all it does is call in to question or make people notice the difference between quality and what's not quality. And I think it's up to us to show the quality and tell why that's important and allow people to see that. And I think that there's still opportunities for success there. I just don't know that it's the same as it was 10 years ago. We're in the buggy whip business now, so things are changing. How does that leave me on time?
You're good. If you want to throw in a couple more comments, you got about 30 seconds left.
Oh, I'm too concise. My wife is probably listening to this, not understanding what's happening. But no, I think there's still opportunity for success in being able to do it. I just don't think it's easy. I think there's, in our metropolis, there's probably only a handful of photographers making a living taking pictures. There's a lot of weekend warriors and people doing it that way. So it probably, the more of those, it takes away from the people who do it full time. But I have a hard time believing that it's going away, and it's more based on what you're doing and how you're doing it. It's tougher, but it isn't gone.
Perfect. Meep. Actually, you came in
yes.
A couple seconds under the nose. That was great. Thank you. Good thoughts. And who wants to be next? Okay, nobody's volunteering, so I will volunteer for you. Barry, go ahead and give your thoughts. Is the photography business dying? All right, thank you, Barry. And moving on.
That was really quick. Did he say anything, or did I miss that?
Did you black out, Dennis? Are you okay?
I think I might have. Where am I? Why is this computer on?
Wait, hang on. For some reason, are you there, Barry? Welcome to live programming. Okay, he keeps showing us muted. I'm going to try and unmute him. Barry?
I'm back.
Barry, there you are. What happened?
Droid. My droid just decided that call was long enough and just disconnected.
Very nice. Very nice. That's awesome. Hey, you are up, though, with Is the Photography Business Dying? You have got 2 minutes, Barry. Mr. B. Groover, go.
I think the business of photography is changing dramatically, and while I don't think it's dying per se, I think that the opportunities will be there for lots and lots and lots of people to do little bits of business all over the place. I think we will see more and more people shooting just a few weddings, just a few portraits, just a few events, sports, whatever. And they'll be very satisfied with that because they won't be making a living from it. They won't be needing to make a living from it. It will just simply be a really fun little part-time thing. The entry level is so easy. The bar is so low for people to hang a shingle and say, hey, I can shoot your wedding. Bang. I think that is where we're going to see the big change. Now, having said that, I totally agree that the opportunity will always be there for people who really know what they're doing. The challenge is that rising above the din and the noise to get your message out is going to become more and more problematic. And my fear is that the clients are going to be less and less discerning as I don't think they're going to search as hard. I don't think they have to search as hard. So that will be the challenge, I think, for the professional side of the industry to keep your message out there. I think many of us have very compelling messages once we have an opportunity to talk with a bride, let's say, or to show our wear or to get them to our website or whatever it happens to be. I just think it's getting more and more difficult to get to that conversation where they can, again, exercise some hopefully good decision-making and actually choose to hire a photographer that knows what they're doing. We all, those of us that do this every day of the week, hear increasing stories of customers who hire the wrong photographer because they didn't know any better and the photographer didn't know any better. Photographer showed some nice pictures on Facebook, and just like that, they had hired the wrong photographer. So that's going to be a challenge because I'm hoping that the pendulum will start swinging because hopefully there's enough bad experiences, not that they're all bad, but we need to not be shy as professionals to really jump on and, you know, get in people's face a little bit more aggressively to help educate them. We hear that all the time. Much easier said than done. So I think the future will be there as technology makes it different. Who knows what will happen?
Excellent. Excellent. Perfect. Barry, good thoughts. And Barry, you went 27.78 seconds over, and I'm going to have to pull that off your rollover seconds from the last show.
We
have rollover.
I would like to give him 27.8 seconds of my time, if I could.
Because I'm not due for the deferment.
Let me check the bylaws. I'm not sure we can allow that. But
okay. I'll
see what we can do. Okay. Mr. Dennis.
Because I will be much shorter, because that Barry says it all a lot more eloquently than I ever could right there. It'd be a lot more stuttering and slurring. Let's start this way. No, you got to think about, why did people hire a professional photographer, let's say even 10 years ago? And it was because the cost of entry to that profession was so high. You would have to buy film, buy the camera, buy the lenses, and then get the film processed, make prints. And now, with the digital cameras, everyone's got one. Everybody is basically a photographer. Some more skilled and technically skilled than the others, but basically everyone has these cameras, these tools in their hand that it used to go to a professional to use. An analogy that I usually make a lot with Barry is, look at like the people who used to drive around town and deliver blocks of ice to your house before refrigeration. You know, it was like, that's how you kept your food cold. You needed a guy with a truck, a big truck full of ice, and he'd go around house to house and sell it. Well, once people started getting their own refrigerators, and then the refrigerators and freezers could make their own ice, I mean, how many ice delivery guys do you see driving around? Just something to think about.
Right.
So if you were to ask me, is the profession of photography dying? I would lean way more towards yes than no, because a lot of people, for the most situations, they're just going to be fine with their cameras and their trash can icon in the back of their cameras, and they'll be just fine with that. The ones who are looking for a specific niche or product shots for their business or promo shots, and they really want to hire someone that knows how to do it, that's the slim thing there, slim opportunity there. And then the phrase that Barry has said before that I totally agree with is that the cameras today have made it super easy for people to take pretty decent /okay/good pictures. But it's going to be harder and harder for people to make a living doing photography as their profession.
All right. Perfect. Thank you, sir. And also, good thoughts. I guess I am up 2 minutes. I'll be ruthless on myself here, really try and cram it in there. And Gavin here on, is the photography business dying? And go. I think the photography business is not dying. But I think it's changing to such a vast degree that a lot of the businesses are going to die. And I think this is where the crossover has to be, is the businesses that can cross over and keep making a product that people want. Guest 30 said people will always need images in their life. And yes, photography is a valuable thing. It's going to keep being there. The issue is, if everybody could make their own images that are just as good, which they can't, but if they don't have a level of appreciation to want something that's of quality, then photographers are going to have a hard time making it in business. So the issue, I think, for photographers is an appreciation of quality. First of all, they have to raise the bar. They have to produce quality and market a product that's a high quality, and they have to build that market, I think, in the future is where it's going to go. I think eventually the fad of photography, you know, everybody's going to enjoy cameras, I think, forever. But I think the fad of being a photographer will go down. People will realize it's a ton of work. You don't make much money, all that kind of stuff. People will also realize, hey, there's a lot of bad photos being made. I want something unique. I want something better than my friend Joey had at his wedding, where he had all these cruddy snapshots and paid something for them. If I pay something for them, I want quality. I just think the quality level has to keep going up. I think the photography industry has to realize they're not photographers simply by owning a camera. And in the long term, you may get some jobs here and there, but in the long term, where the business is going to go is, I think there will still be some low end and people hiring low end, but I think people are going to want quality. And if you actually want to make it actively in business and do it as a profession, we have to find a way to show people the value in quality and sell them something of quality. I'm out of time. We'll leave it at that for now. Okay, does anybody else want to chime in on this? With that, let's just take a minute and kind of, anybody want to rebuttal or say any other thoughts? I think for the most part, we kind of were agreeing, but anybody have any last thoughts? We'll take just a couple minutes to recap.
I think there's a big market, and I think a lot of the wedding, I come at it from wedding photography since that's where my experience is. I think a lot of wedding photographers saw this and decided that they were, instead of booking weddings, they were going to now teach seminars and workshops. And so I think there's a lot of photographers who've changed over their entire business to where they're not shooting weddings anymore. A lot of the big names that most people know who are in photography aren't shooting many weddings anymore, because they aren't able to keep up charging the same amount because the quality is getting better and the prices are going down. And so they're getting into that niche of people who want to take better pictures. And I've seen a ton of people go to those seminars, those workshops, and their work doesn't get much better for the most part. And it still comes down to vision, quality, emotion, and all of those things that you need to do that you can't really be taught in a seminar situation.
Right, right. And I think that you raise a good point on weddings, Matt, because that's kind of where everybody wants to run to. I don't know why everybody wants to start with weddings, because they're one of the hardest things, in my opinion, but that's kind of where they go to, is to weddings. So weddings are so saturated. And like you said, the high-end people, they're because there's so many people out there working, a lot of them aren't real good, but there is stuff out there that you can get for less. And you take somebody like me, I'm not willing to do a wedding for cheap. So because of that, I'm not focusing on weddings that much. I'm not getting a ton of weddings. And it's not my primary focus. On the other hand, you look at the other industries like architecture and commercial and family portraits and things like that. Yes, there's a lot of startups out there, people just jumping in, going for it on that as well, but not to the same degree of weddings. There's also a lot of businesses that say, hey, we can just do it ourselves. We'll take our own photos. And I think a lot of times they find out it's not as easy as they thought to do it well. And I think kind of with that, we're going to come back more to there's going to be a demand for quality too. I think it might take a little longer on weddings because there's so many people running out and doing weddings. I don't know if anybody.
And Gavin, I'm gonna jump and say that while that is very logical, that statement, I think there's an ounce of naivety to that from the standpoint that while that's absolutely true, and yes, I think a lot of photographers find out that weddings aren't nearly as easy to shoot as it seems that they would be. I think for every one of those disenchanted photographers that packs up their little DSLR kit camera and says, gee, I'm just not going to do weddings anymore, I think for every one that goes away, there's five more behind them. And I think that we're going to just see, I think we're going to see this thing ramp up more and more as because basically the DSLR quality keeps going up, the price keeps going down, and it's all about, you know, again, I just keep coming back to it, that the fundamental question. I've been at this thing long enough where I booked weddings back when brides came in clutching their little bride's magazine, going over a checklist, and that they were petrified that they would make the wrong choice and not hire, you know, a good, competent photographer. And Dennis worked for us during kind of the last part of those years where these brides, they wanted to know, what's your backup camera? What happens if you get sick? Can I see a wedding that only you shot and just one wedding? And they had these same questions they would ask, but they definitely looked in your eyes and they wanted confidence that you would be the guy and do a great job for them. We went from a brides who are paranoid about making a bad decision to now a million of them that hire people that they've never even met in many cases. And some of them are fine and some of them are satisfied. And some of them find the mats and some of the photographers like that that really do a great job that are on the newer end of this. But so many of them just never even understand that. So it's like, logically, how did that bride change?
A lot of them don't find them. And if you go around, you know, I've had people where I did post on Pro Photo Show that were saying, hey, you know, you need to actually learn your craft and you need to, you know, not rush into it, that kind of thing. And they'll say, oh, stop picking on the newbies. You shouldn't be giving them trouble. Well, go to some wedding boards and it's really easy to find brides that are in tears because of their wedding photos. So Barry, what you're saying is spot on. But I think what might change, I think what's happened is that there's so many people with cameras, so many people saying they're artists, these cameras have gotten really good, that they worry about it less because they think, oh, it's going to be fine. This person has a great camera. They're going to be able to do it. The technology's changed. It's easy now. But in truth, it's not so much easier. And I do think in time what we're going to see because these girls are still spending $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on these weddings. It's nonsensical that they're spending $600,000, $800,000 on their photographs. I really think that the weddings aren't going away, and I think we will see people coming back to, no chance am I having somebody do my wedding that has no idea what they're doing, because I think the fad will start to die and people will start to realize there's quality to be had, that owning a camera does not make you a photographer.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. I just fear that you're not. Yep. I just fear that as the technology continues to make good pictures easier and easier and easier to take. And you got to remember, and I'm seeing this because I deal with clients, you know, from youth sports all the way up through, obviously, you know, the weddings and the senior pictures and the whole, you know, shebang all the way up the chain. We are seeing a drastic trend in the young people, let's just call them the high school age kids, you know, coming through. They care less and less and less about physical pictures because their entire world from day one has been an electronic screen. I bet Gavin, right. I bet your brand new 5-year-old kid has probably already touched an iPhone. And, yeah. You know, I mean, it's part of their DNA right out of the gate. So that makes it all the more challenging when we're trying to sell a craft and, you know, a complete service
exactly.
to potentially a market that is valuing the actual print. They don't want wall portraits. They don't want fancy albums. They want galleries to put on their phones and on Facebook and so on. So that's
right. Well, and I hope I'm right, but I think in part the photographers who want to make it in business, they're the ones that have to change this. I think we do have to educate our clients. Let's get AJW Studios in here, and I'm going to unmute you over there, buddy, and he has a couple comments for us. And if anybody else does too, we'll get you in here. Just raise your hand or let me know in the chat that you want to say something. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here. How are you guys?
Doing good. What are your thoughts?
I was just going to add that I still feel that the majority of people, they feel they can find someone that can do it on the cheap or good enough. And so I feel that for a while, I'm going to side with Barry and DZ here, that, you know, for a while, we're going to be in a time where photographers are really not going to get what we used to get. However, I've been able to meet a few people here recently where they've had enough friends encounter some bad photographers where it's starting to come around, but I think it'll take a long time.
I don't know if it'll take as long. I think part of that, again, depends on the photographers getting out there, because the thing is, if I show somebody the value, I mean, I've been to this wall portraits, and that's not what everybody's into, but what I do with my product is I show the value in something that's of a higher quality than the average, and they buy it almost every time. So people will buy the product. Not that the approach is going to be the same for everybody, but I think this ultimately, who's going to have to change this is the photographers. You're going to have to find a way. We're going to have to find a way to show people here is quality. And also, I think it's going to take time for them to start to realize it. But if we find a way to illustrate that and to show, you know, this is the difference. I'm a professional photographer. Those are snapshots. Without actually maybe saying that so directly, I mean, you have to show, not tell.
Well, I don't think quality is going to be the key selling point. I think it's going to be laziness. I think right now, because the economy is so poor, everybody's looking for the cheaper option, and so they're willing to settle. And if the economy, which I think it will, when, I don't know, but it will come back at some point, and people will say, well, it's just easier to hire someone that does it good. And that's when they're starting to invest more in it, then they'll be a bit more picky.
Hey, if I could pipe in here, I agree. I mean, the whole concept, we're taking a massive concept of the photography industry, this monolith, and really that doesn't have any implications to me personally, because all I have to do is convince 40 or so brides per year that they need to hire me. So I don't have to change society's views on what a photographer does. I just need a bride to look at my work and say, that's what I want. And then all I need to do that is make happy clients. And those happy clients refer other clients. And so it's a very personal relationship that you're building. And it's hard to think about it on a massive scale. I had a bride who didn't care about pictures at all. She hired a photographer because he was local and he was the one that people hired, and that's what she had to do, except he canceled because my thoughts are somebody booked a higher package, and so he canceled on her. Well, I went to a friend I went to high school with and haven't seen in a long time, was friends with her and friends with me on Facebook, and said, hey, you should hire my friend. Well, that meant that this May I flew out to Hawaii to photograph her wedding, and so she had no care about it at all. And then once she started looking, she recognized the difference. So I think it comes down to us being able to show what that difference is. And if you can show what the difference is, then you're going to be able to talk to people and book people and stay busy. But thinking about changing the minds of everybody out there, there's just no way to do that.
Well, I think to change public opinion takes a long time, but I think you have to start somewhere. And but you do, I mean, your point is really good. Basically, what you're coming to is relationships, and that's a huge part. Part of, you know, a relationship can be a major part in showing somebody value and showing them that relevance. So I think that that's super important. But I really do think, I guess I feel like a lot of photographers say, oh, I want to do this or that, I want to sell a high-end product, but they don't really follow it through. People buy furniture, they buy cars. The economy's bad. Hopefully that'll change. But people are still buying things. And yet people will say, oh, I never sell prints. I never do this. I don't sell albums. Well, if you don't show quality prints, you're not going to sell prints. If you don't have albums that, yes, you have paid for and that you have them and you know how to sell them and, you know, you're trying to sell them, you're not going to sell albums. Somebody, guest eight said, do you guys think giving discs of images kills the industry? I don't think it does at all. I used to give discs as my mainstay, and I would never sell prints properly. And I'm like, what am I going to do? What's the deal here? I went to Wall Portrait Conference. I tried to figure out a system. But what I did was not quit offering the disc. What I did is use the disc as an incentive, and I sold the disc differently. I didn't sell a disc as, oh, get this disc and you won't have to spend money on print. I sold the disc as, this disc is so you can make your own little prints, and that's all it's for, is for small prints, so that you can use that studio credit that comes with this premium package to buy a quality print. Or maybe it's you're selling albums or whatever it is you want to do. One thing I see a lot of in the photography industry is photographers, they want to sell a high-end product. So the first thing they do is they go out and find the cheapest samples, you know, that's the latest gimmick from their lab that they can find, and then think they're going to slap a high price tag on it and sell it. And if you want to sell a quality high-end piece of furniture, you don't go buy particle board and make a junky piece of furniture. You have to make a quality piece of furniture. So on the end, I'm kind of a little bit off topic, but on the end of selling something that's of a higher value, of selling something that, yes, people will buy something higher end, there's ways to do it, but you have to follow through. You have to show if you want to sell.
Yeah, fair enough.
But and admittedly, that's a little off topic. Everybody has good points here. And let's close this one down and move on to another one. Andrew, thank you for chiming in.
Thank you.
I'm gonna mute you, but you're welcome to pop back up here. And if anybody else out here wants to get on, by all means, get into that audio. I think part of the problem here is it's kind of a talk show is not the easiest thing to get in the audio. But
Northern Horse in the chat room asks, where do you think, since we've been talking about weddings to death here, what do you think of, where do you think landscapes and landscape photography is headed? Or yeah, I know we should probably set a timer for this and get ready
okay,
for
yeah,
the
let's
Gavin
do this.
Storm.
This
a Gavin subject.
Her question was, do you see any future in that or where that's headed?
Let's talk about that, but let's make it a little broader. I'm kind of into landscapes, but let's talk about the art side of photography just a little. And I don't think any of us here are making our living on that. There is a few people, but let's just do it a quick one on that and have everybody kind of chime in and see what they think would be a way to sell a fine art product and actually do it in a profitable way. So we'll do a 1 minute lightning round for this one, and everybody take their minute. So let's start, Dennis, with you. And see what your thoughts are on this, because I know you actually go out and you spend some time with landscapes and stuff like that. I don't know if you sell any or not, but let's just talk about the fine art topic in general. We always tend to gravitate towards weddings. Is there a market for fine art photography? Dennis, go ahead.
You sure you want to start with me on this?
Go
one?
For it.
You know that it's a pet peeve of mine to call photography fine art, and I won't get into that today.
That can be another lightning round. But okay,
Northern Horse
call
knows
it
how
want.
I feel about calling that. I'll go artistic. I'll call it that. But yeah, if you would call that more artistic landscape photography, I personally just, I shoot it because that's what I started shooting, you know, 18 years ago when I started to become a professional photographer, kind of alongside with weddings and portraits. I got into like night photography and astrophotography, and that kind of, ever since then, it's pretty much all over the place. If it looks like a gorgeous scene, I'll shoot some pictures of it. Been dabbling in infrared. As far as me with that kind of photography, I basically shoot it for myself and just like to have it. I'll put some things up on Facebook and not aggressively sell it, but I'll get people who will see it and contact me, and then we'll make some prints from there. But other than that, it's just something I just kind of do for myself. I like to hang up pictures in my own home here and
sure.
Things to have around. But otherwise, that's how I go about that. So I don't know
Perfect.
If that's
Perfect.
Any good, but I'll give some extra time to Barry if I have any.
Actually, you're out of time, so you're perfect.
Next time,
okay.
Barry. I'll get
so
you next
excellent.
Time.
That was Dennis, and let's go to Matt. Do you think there is a market in the art side of photographs?
I have no idea.
If you had to
That's
go out
minute.
Right now, if you had to go out right now and find a way to make a living selling artistic photographs, how would you do it?
I think it's personal. I think to me, what I've seen is photography is personal. And so, so taking pictures of just general parks and trying to sell that on a matted print, I don't know that the market is always going to be very strong for that. There's always going to be a market. I don't think that's a growth industry. But I can see a way of making personalized ones. I live in a place where there's a lot of landowners who own massive amounts of land. I do a lot of backyard weddings on acreage. And so I could definitely see a need there for photographs of their land, beautiful, amazing photographs of their land in different times of the year that people would want to put on their walls because it's personal to them and it's their land. But I don't know that the market exists or will grow just for the art gallery type of fine art or landscape photography, if that makes
right.
any sense.
Right, right. Okay, perfect. Thank you, sir. And I guess I will go ahead and go, and then we'll wrap it up with Barry, and I'll give my thoughts. This is actually something I've been analyzing pretty intensively the past year or so because it's a direction I'm wanting to go. So I'll give myself my 90 seconds here. So selling fine art photography. I think, yes, there is. I think fine art photography, it is about being personal, like Matt said. I think it's absolutely about a brand. I've spent a lot of time on the road in the past year, two or three months on the road. I always go into photography galleries and kind of see if people are making it and see what they're doing, see what they're selling. I have ran across a few like the Michael Fatalis, the Rodney Lowe's, things like that, where these guys are selling high-end, $5,000-$10,000 prints. I don't know how many they're selling, but I it seems like they're doing pretty well in terms of I see growth with these photographers. They seem to sell products. Peter Lick's another one, sells really high-end stuff. I mean, if you look on eBay, you can find Peter Lick prints going for $5,000-$6,000. And I suppose it helps. He got a TV show recently on Nature Discovery Channel or something like that. But I think what's happening here is it's a brand. And I don't think in that sense so much has changed from go back 200 years and painters were making these pieces. Yes, they're famous now, but at the time they were being commissioned, but they had patrons or they had a brand and people wanted their pieces. And I don't think it's so different. I think oftentimes photographers, they run out and snap, 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 snap and take photos. And at that point, no, it's not fine art. But I think that absolutely you can make a spectacular art piece that is equal with a painting in terms of being a stunning piece of art on the wall, but I think you can't just run out and take a bunch of photos. I mean, yes, it may take hours or days to make a single piece. If I go on a month trip and come home with a couple really, really good pieces that I would be willing to sell, I'm satisfied with that. So I think the quality, how you present it, the print, all that kind of stuff is huge if you want to sell fine art. Or creative photographs or whatever we want to call them. But I think at the same time, your personal brand is huge too. People have to know you. There has to be a reason more than just it's pretty that they want it on the wall. And my buzzer's going, so I'm going to stop there and we can maybe come back to this another time. But that's my thoughts. And Mr. Barry, you've got about 90 seconds. Is there a market in the creative slash art side of photography?
I think there will always be a market. I think the market is defining itself, separating itself from the very, very high end to the not so high end. I think that, again, the price value is being driven down because I think people are less impressed with beautiful photography because their own cameras are producing better images. And all of a sudden that sunset that they take at the lake or at the ocean or in Hawaii suddenly doesn't look all that bad when they go into a beautiful gallery and see a print for $1,200 or $1,500. It doesn't look like it's really worth it because it doesn't look that much more awesome and amazing. You know, the Rodney Lowe Gallery at the Mall of America closed, you know, Gab, just about a month after you were here, which is amazing because that guy is as good as it gets with beautiful landscape photography, selling prints for thousands of dollars, but, you know, obviously it's a very expensive mall and he wasn't able to sustain it there. So I think there's a market there. I just think it's going to be more difficult. And I wonder if maybe, I've always wondered now if some of the other kinds of arts, painting and sculptures, if they maybe don't have more value in galleries than photography because photography has become a little more mainstream. Done.
Perfect. Excellent, Barry. Thank you. And we'll take a couple minutes for rebuttals here. And if anybody in the chat room wants to chime in, that's cool too. To be fair, Barry, Rodney Lowe's gallery did close, and I'm sure it was probably because it wasn't making as much money, but he does have other galleries. So just to be clear, I don't
absolutely.
Think he's in any way out of his.
And I didn't say that. I just
no, I know.
That
I'm just gallery, clarifying.
Which was, that was a showcase gallery of his in his, I mean, that is as good a market or as good as a mall as you think you could ever get in. And I just think as awesome as those images are, you know, the number of buyers, I think, is diminishing. And, you know, to a degree, it's tied to the economy, maybe. But I think the people buying those pieces, they send their home designer in to pick out the images. I don't think they're
right.
buying them anyway.
Right. Well, and
that's
I think the significance of, you know, you talk about people running around and they stumble over a sunset and they take a photo. I think that kind of reaffirms that one way or the other, a pictorialist, as I would call them, needs to do something that's substantial and amazing enough. Just taking a good photo is not good enough. I mean, whether it be you make a spectacular photo in the camera or you present it large or really, really stunningly on metal or canvas or whatever your approach or your medium is, you have to do something that makes it a purchasable item that somebody desires. Ultimately, selling a piece of art, akin to me to selling a piece of furniture. You have to give somebody something that's beautiful and stunning enough, more than just, hey, I made a 30-inch print. Do you want to pay me a lot of money? I mean, sometimes if I make a large pictorial on canvas, I might spend $500 just putting that piece together, and I keep going higher and higher because now that I'm into 4x5, I mean, my approach, not that that's the only one, is to do these large pieces because very few people are doing it, and very few inexperienced photographers are capable of making a 100-inch print. The market's also going to be small. But on the other hand, I don't need a lot of people. So that's just kind of the direction I'm going. But one way or the other, I think if we want to sell something high-end, it has to be more than just making a poster and sticking it in an envelope and saying, hey, do you want to give me $500 for this? It has to be something significant. It has to be something that makes people say, yes, I want to do it. But even at that, it's really hard. And I think the brand and the renown of the person doing it is huge. And I think it's hard now. But I think it's always been hard to sell that kind of stuff. I don't think it's anything new that you have to build a brand. But I'm talking too long. Anybody else have any rebuttals here?
It comes down to finding the market. You know, where are those animals? How are you going to sell the kind of art? I think that's the challenge. You know, it's strictly an internet world that we're in. And, you know, our friend Larry, you know, he's been kind of beating his head against the wall for 5 years on that topic. He creates awesome images. Getting them into the hands of people willing to buy them, whole other topic. So
right.
There you go.
And I think also there's a market, but it again comes down to people and connecting with people. And so places like Hawaii or destinations where there might be an opportunity to be a landscape photographer who takes amazing landscapes. Well, when people come visit, they stay for a week and they don't see an amazing sunset the entire time they're there. But they
yeah.
want to remember that visit. They're going to go to a gallery, look through, and see this is a photo that will be on our wall in a frame, in a mat, huge on our wall that will remind us of this trip that we took. And so I think there's little niche type of places where people, there's a market, but I don't think just the general you know, unless you're selling to somewhere like Costco, where it's interior design or interior decorating, or somewhere like IKEA, something like that. I think that's it, because that's what people are filling their homes with, is things like that.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting, and obviously it's harder now because there's a lot more photos being made, but I was watching Ken Burns' History on the National Parks, and the Kulb brothers in the Grand Canyon, I think their studio is still there now, but these guys went in there, and they were roaming around the Grand Canyon, and I think this might have started even before it was officially a national park, and they were doing these photos, and they would have this thing. I really thought it was interesting, because on the one hand, they were doing this high volume thing. They had this thing where people that came to the Grand Canyon, they'd be like on a mule going down the trail into the Grand Canyon, and one of the brothers would be on the trail as they just came down inside the rim, and he would be there with his large format camera, and he would take a photo of this person as they rode down, and their expression of awe and fear or whatever it was as they rode into here. Then he would take that film, run down like a mile down the hill to a tent where his brother was developing, give him these negatives. He would develop those and have them for the people when they got there. And this is the large format days, remember? So he'd have these for the people when they got down to that point on the trail so they could buy them. And then his other brother would run back up the trail to do it all over again. And so there's their high volume side. Then they started going down the river and doing these landscapes of the Grand Canyon. And they had their little studio, and they started doing these Grand Canyon landscapes, and they couldn't keep them in stock. Now, that's not going to happen the same today, because now everybody's taking photos. I just thought it was interesting that these guys did the high volume, and then all of a sudden they started selling the art piece approach and the landscapes, and they were selling the daylights out of them. But this isn't, you know, this isn't 1910.
Yeah, exactly. I just
thought it was an interesting.
Well, I do have to say that I'm in awe of people that take amazing landscapes. I don't have the vision. My vision isn't developed enough to see them. When I see something beautiful outside, I don't see it. And so when I see the people who over and over and over create these amazing landscapes, right, I'm in awe of it. And
well,
it's just something that I don't do.
And and most people aren't doing really good landscapes. And I don't mean to, you know, be harsh here. I'm probably irritating somebody right now. But honestly, most people take landscapes in the sense of, oh, you know, they run around with their camera and they take a photo, and then they make a blog post and post 30 photos from this cool place. A painter didn't go out and make as many paintings as he could. He went for a single or a small group of really amazing pieces. And if your landscape is a little more than a snapshot, I mean, I see people all the time and they post a photo of a landscape. And I don't say this, but sometimes what I'm thinking is, that's a really beautiful landscape. It's too bad you didn't take a beautiful photo of it. Because just because there's a great landscape does not mean you can just go take a snap of it and you have a piece of art. I think that's the difference between a piece of art. And I'm not going to try and define where the line is. I'm just kind of musing here, in that if it's a commodity, if it's something that everybody's doing, it's going to be that much harder to sell. Maybe there's still a way to do it. But anyway, I don't want to go on this too long. I think it's been an interesting topic. And I'd love to do a lightning round too on, you know, the art value, the fine art value of photography. So maybe we'll come back, Dennis, and have a metered round on that one another day.
Yeah, I might need 5 minutes on that one.
We might, but we'll meter ourselves in some way so we don't turn it into the whole show. In any case, and yeah, Zach Baker, yes, that was it's a really interesting and educational series on the national parks, Ken Burns National Parks, and it's on Netflix live streaming too, which is cool. So I've been watching that in the evenings. But anyway, good topics, and my opinions have been known to change on this. I'm really trying to analyze this too, because that's an area that I want to grow in. I mean, I love going out and going on the road and doing landscapes. So any other, let's squeeze one more quick lightning round in, then we'll go to some picks of the week, and then we will call it a day, because this show is actually going to be about normal length by the time I edit off all the crud at the beginning where we were having so many problems. So I'm just looking here if anybody else wants to call in. I was really hoping for more of you to call in, and I don't know, maybe we won't do the live shows if there's not an interest in people calling in. We actually have quite a few people in here, but I guess people aren't really wanting to dial in, which is cool. So we might maybe we'll do less of these in the future and just do the recording and post it later, because it definitely is less aesthetics to deal with in terms of management.
Well, so, I think we could have, I think if we get Andrew back on, he can do a different voice, like either higher or lower.
He can too, like
just a suggestion. Yeah, oh, never mind. He'll be right back. Forget it. Next topic.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm more intimidating than I realize, and people just don't want to get on the live phone. You guys are.
They just haven't met you yet, Gavin. That's all.
Maybe
we all met you.
Maybe it's you Minnesotan guys that are intimidating.
No, you
got that Minnesota nice.
Yeah, we got the Minnesota nice.
A guest 30, I would welcome a girl on my panel, but none has called in yet.
Hint.
I thought that was a really good response. I'm just saying. Hey, and to be fair, we did have Adina on last time, and that was fun. All right, let's...
Maybe what about, Gavin, what about favorite places to learn about photography or things that places they go to learn about?
Let's learn. That's a good one. That should be fun. We can crank out a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, get your pencils ready, because I have a feeling there's going to be a good list.
Yes, exactly. Guest 30 says a panel of all girls. The problem with that guest 30 is if I had a panel of all girls, I wouldn't have a chance to talk. Ooh. that was
wow.
Hope there's no girls listening. Oh wait, there's girls listening. No, I'm just kidding. I really enjoy it actually when we have girls on, because sometimes us, you know, we get this whole bachelor pad thing going sometimes and start talking about weird stuff, you know. Anyway, okay.
Latex pants.
Yes, skin tight latex pants. Which
awkward.
Is actually kind of a, well, never mind. Let's. Okay, Matt, you will go last since it's your topic. You can hear what other people say. But this probably isn't going to be so much a debating topic as just sharing some ideas. So Matt's is ideas for learning, and let's do this. Let's just take everybody, just give a minute and a half, 2 minutes, talk about your favorite places to get information, to learn, to improve your skill on photography, whether it's websites or books or whatever. How do you make yourself a better photographer? Because I think in all these topics of, you know, trying to keep business is strong and find ways to stand out, I think being as good a photographer as we can is very relevant. So, Barry, let's start with you. You ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, go for it, Barry. You got 90 seconds.
I always start by trying to identify who I can find that is the very best at any given specific thing I'm trying to learn more about. And whether that means going back to articles that were written in 1920, or if it means finding somebody who popped on the scene 2 years ago, I want to find the very best people at any given thing, not in a broad sense, but in a very specific micro topical sense. And then I'm always the first to research them. If they have a book, I want to go look at that book. I want to maybe find that book. I want to read very specific, not going to just go out and run and shoot from the hip quite literally and just experiment to death. Let me just try and absorb what it is they're trying to say. I have attended seminars only in the workshops that are, again, laser specific to something that I'm keenly interested in, and again, have topically searched and find somebody who's really, really good at it. Then once I start putzing with it and start learning a little bit more, then it's all about trying to apply it and then bounce some ideas off some of my little posse and people that I'm in communication with, where I can throw some ideas and maybe say, hey, here's something I'm working at. What do you think about that? And they often will then direct me to a whole new series of learning, whether it's, oh, here's a book that so-and-so wrote about this, or here's a website, or here's a podcast, or here's something. So it's awesome to see. And, of course, now with all of the YouTube videos and all of the accessibility to learning at our fingertips, that's all great, but just because it's on the internet doesn't mean that it's quality information, so I want to really vet that out before I waste any time doing any research and trying to learn anything.
Thank you, Barry. Good stuff. I will go ahead and go this time. I'll give myself that, again, 90 seconds, and then we'll go to Dennis, and we'll wrap up with Mr. Shoemate.
Yes.
Okay, so for learning, there's so many resources out there, and yet a lot of resources are getting ignored, I think. Yes, the internet's huge, blogs, all that kind of stuff. Stalking blogs, forums, those are like the mainstay, you know, things. Go out there, hang out. They're good for meeting people, all that kind of stuff. But everybody wants learning to be easy now, and it's not always easy. Yes, sometimes you're going to have to pay for a workshop. I mean, I see people saying, oh, well, I can't afford to actually pay for a workshop. And, you know, they just went out and spent $600 on a new flash. Maybe use the gear that you have and go out and learn to work with it better. That said, you don't always have to pay for learning. I just think that we shouldn't rule that out. I think going to people that are experienced, spending particularly workshops where you're spending days with people, could be really valuable. On the other side of that coin is books. We always want something that's quick content. I mean, when I write posts on Pro Photo Show, I feel like I need to keep them 500 to 800 words, because if people have to spend more than 3 minutes learning what I'm talking about, they're just going to leave. Not always, but I do a lot of things, you know, 10 tips, this kind of stuff. The reason that you see those all over the internet is because they work well. So go out, get some books, particularly study the old stuff. Another way is talking to the old timers, the long time experienced people back in the film days. Photography has 150 years of history, and yet 10 years ago we got to digital, and for the most part it seems like a lot of the things learned in that 150 years of history, nobody's paying any attention to them, as if everything's changed. But everything hasn't changed at all. Our medium and the way we capture has changed to a degree. But the techniques and the skills of photography go all the way back to the beginning of photography and back into painting. Studying old paintings, I think, is huge too. And, you know, look at classical art and go as far back as you want. Look at how they were doing things. Think about how they used light and how they made art, how much time they spent on making a piece really good, and see how you can find different resources that kind of fit you, the style that you want to go towards, and to make it really good. I am out of time. I'm over time exactly. So I am stopping. And yes, I was timing me. Look what happened. No, I couldn't believe how fast. I should have made it a 2 second. Anyway, Mr. Matt, you are.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
learning.
I guess since it's my topic, I better come through here. But a couple of different things that I've found. One is everybody should know Zach Arias as far as flash and lighting, but by far the most beneficial thing I've ever seen him do is he has a series on his website where he goes through and critiques people who've sent in websites and things for him to critique. Now, he's very specific. He's opinionated. But there is so much information in there when he talks. It is just massive amounts of content about what people can do to get better. Even if he's not looking at your things, you can definitely apply. And I'm not kidding. That's the number one thing that happened to me that I learned from in getting better and being able to create a marketable product. I go to fashion magazines. I subscribe to a bunch of fashion magazines. Fortunately, I have 3 daughters and a wife, so it doesn't look as awkward to the mailman as it would if I was just a single guy. But definitely fashion magazines. You can see a lot in there that people are doing and new and creative ways of portraits. Things like Flickr forums are always great. National Geographic has a DVD that is incredible. It's the 10 incredible or top 10 photos. It's a recent DVD, and it's incredible. It's amazing about photojournalism, and it goes through and dissects 10 photos and how they were created. And I've learned a ton just being a wedding photographer by watching that DVD. The things that they don't apply whatsoever to what I do, but the concepts apply. And the last thing I'd say is ask a pro. I get phone calls and emails all the time, people asking questions, and I'm happy to help. Sometimes I can't always help as much as I'd like, but if somebody offered to take me out to lunch or something, I'd be sure to give them my time. And I'm always looking to help and help create a better market and people who want to put the effort in and work in, I want to help them out. I think I'm probably about there.
Yes, you are. Thank you, sir. Good. Okay. Well, let's take a couple of minutes then and just kind of recap. I mean, wait, did I get everybody? I think did Dennis go?
No.
Yes. Okay, Dennis. Wah. Your favorite learning places? Go.
For photography? Well, see, I love hearing what Matt had to say, because Matt is, he's learning these days. Like he's learned more. He's just gotten started on his journey with photography, it sounds like, even though I missed the middle of his bio rap there. It sounds like if he's been listening to the show, he's kind of learning in this digital time, whereas I was starting out 18 years ago, I remember thinking if there was – I remember just being thirsty for stuff like this. I mean, we got it so easy now with the internet, you know, to type in a search topic and, you know, portrait photography and be just overloaded with photos and videos and tutorials and you name it, you got it. Back then, it was impossible to even find a VHS. Yes, kids, we didn't have DVDs back then. We had VHS where you had to adjust the tracking on it and to try to find
that.
You. Yeah, wasn't that fun? That's all we had. So back then, the majority of learning was done by working with mentors like Barry, like other photographers that I worked for who had been doing it for even back then 20, 15 years. That's where I learned the bulk of my knowledge from back then. So it's interesting to hear Matt talk about and everything Matt said. And you can tell by the way he's enthusiastic about it too. And that Zach is amazing as well. But those are great, some great resources. One thing that I probably found about 10 years ago was the PhotoVision DVD set. Anybody who's listened to the show knows that I've mentioned them before and gone to a few of the seminars. But that's a neat way just to kind of get a feel for you're working with different clients. I'm sure they're paid models, but at least you kind of see like the flow of how things go. That really helped a lot. The only thing I always wish is that they would put in a shot of what it actually looked like untouched and then like right next to it put in the final result image. That's the one thing I wish they would have done. But
right.
And then as far as like learning Photoshop and things like that, same thing. It was just a lot of trial and error, trying stuff on my own. This would have been the late 90s. And then as you know, the internet started to get more tutorials and videos on it, I kind of latched on to Kelby and those guys over at the Photoshop guys and their podcast and their shows. Because they just tackle one thing. And it seems like even if you're not doing that exact same project that they're describing, you're going to pick some little keyboard shortcut or something out of it to make your make it worth your while. So that's
perfect.
About where I'm at these days.
Beep. All right. Thank you, Dennis. Excellent. Let's take just a couple minutes to kind of recap as those of us who went through who thought about other resources who might have mentioned or something like that. And we'll take a couple minutes here. And just quickly, Matt, in a little bit of a rebuttal is, gosh, the fashion magazines. I mean, I agree it's good to look at them, but I bought a Vogue and a Teen Vogue last week, and I was astounded how bad the photos were in them. I mean, how the lighting was terrible. And I mean, you know, there was literally stuff that looked like, you know, purposely they had used on-camera flash and horrible posing, and the people were all slouchy. It was unreal. I'm looking at this magazine and I'm thinking, fashion means like it's fashionable. This isn't fashion. No one in the real world looks like this. I don't know.
Gavin, don't you know the ring flash is totally in these days, Gavin? Come on.
This was no tennis. I'm
no, it's not ring
worse,
flash. It's,
this was
yeah,
worse than ring
definitely.
Flash. This was actually like a point and shoot on camera flash of like this guy slouching against a tree in a tuxedo. And I'm like, my jaw was just dropping at how bad it was. So,
Gavin, don't you know that the on camera flash is all the rage these days?
That's the rage. Well, and I had a discussion with somebody about, you know, we need dimension in our light. And they're like, well, look at fashion photography. It doesn't have a lot of dimension. And first of all, fashion photography for me doesn't define what quality is. But also, let's bear in mind with fashion photography, and not that I'm saying, like Matt said, get some fashion magazines, look at them, maybe get some ideas, because there is some cool stuff in there. But remember that a fashion photo is designed to catch people's eye in whatever way and sell clothing, typically, or whatever the product they're trying to sell. A portrait is different. Yesterday I was talking, I think I was tweeting, and I was analyzing how I was burning and dodging and how I'd lit this portrait. A flat-lit portrait makes a person's face fat. So flat is fat, dimensional light is skinny. And literally it's like I took pounds off this woman's face just by how the dimension was, and this was not a heavy woman. So let's just say that most women don't want to feel fat, and let's think about it, as you're looking through that fashion magazine, just keep dimensional light in mind. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's when I'm looking through, what I do actually is I get the magazine and I flip through, and basically takes me just a few minutes, and I flip through and find the photos that inspire me. Something inspires me, catches my attention, rip them out, and then I toss the magazine. So I just, and then I take a photograph of those things and keep them in my iPad, and then I can scroll through them for inspiration.
Yeah.
But it's definitely. I mean, there's magazines where I don't pull anything out, and then there's some where I pull out a handful, but it's definitely specific things that I'm looking at. Well, and so it's definitely you're editing yourself when you're looking at them, but they're trying to get attention. So sometimes it's that on-camera flash because that's what people recognize, because that's what they're using. And again, you don't have to worry about the dimension of some of those 6'4", 102
exactly.
pound models. So adding dimension to their faces isn't necessarily a bad thing. That's a feature.
Right, right. No, I'm not saying it's a bad resource. I just wanted to comment. Just me ranting, that's all. But let anybody have anything else they want to throw in there, good resources that they may have forgot to mention or things that people should check out that are really valuable?
I actually have one, Gavin.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sound like a commercial for Gavin Syme here, since it's going to sound like that's the reason you had me on. But I remember back to my very first wedding and when I was learning Lightroom and all of that. Really good resource for me was the presets. And not that I don't still use them in the same way, but just being able to get the presets, clicking on the preset, looking through all of the sliders and seeing what the preset did. I learned a ton, and that's basically my Lightroom instruction came from looking at presets, clicking on
dissecting
the button,
them.
Seeing where the slider, dissecting
right.
it and getting into the guts. And now I know how to use it, and I don't need those anymore, and I have my own build. But that's a good way to get in and learn if you're trying
awesome.
To learn
no,
the software.
That's a good point. That's good. And first of all, thank you for the props. Second of all, that is a good way, wherever you're getting your presets, if it's doing something that's really good, the beauty of Lightroom is you can totally go in there and dissect those, getting in there and kind of looking at what's happening. And that's one of the reasons I have to say I love presets. We're always going in and using plugins and this and that. I love presets. Not only for efficiency and stuff like that, but because it's really educational for people to see what they're actually doing to a photo. You raise a good point. And by the way, there's lots of free presets on SimeFX.com if you just want some to play with, go check them out. Okay, now that I turned that into an ad, there was a couple things that I had forgot to mention. And some people covered them, like Creative Live, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of free resources out there. Don't be afraid to go out on your own and just try things and practice. Don't be afraid to read a book. I think basically the thing with education, and this is something I tweeted the other day. I said the problem with photography is not education. It's that we often think we're too good to need it. And this is what I see the most of in the industry. And I see it in myself too. And it kind of slaps me in the face as I go out and I'm looking at particularly at old school photographers, you know, finding old books, things like that, is how much there is out there to photography. And I see a lot of the attitude in photography of my work looks good and it's good enough, as it were, and I know what I'm doing. I don't know if we ever know what we're doing. I mean, there's so much to learn, and I think we should never have the attitude that we're too good to need a good workshop or to read a good book or to find how to refine our techniques or our style to make it something better. And, you know, you got books like the 500 Poses books are cool for inspiration. I think they're available on iPad, too. I'll link them in the show notes. I don't remember the name. But it's just like a big book of all these different poses, which can be great if you're doing a couple or an individual or a wedding or something like that to try and get ideas. Photo Vision, Dennis mentioned that. And don't feel like if you can't absorb it in 10 minutes, it's not worthwhile, because sometimes the ones that take longer are really valuable.
And I have one more thing to add, if I can, before we go. With respect to going and doing a workshop or a presentation or a seminar, I would make sure, if you're going to invest in one of those things, make sure you do your homework on who will be speaking, because there are so many people right now that are out there teaching, teaching classes and technique that have no business doing it.
Exactly.
Yes, people
it's
might learn
like,
something. Another thing that's happening is that now that a few photographers have been doing this 2, 3, 4, 5 years, they're masters at it. It's almost like another additional poison to the industry.
I think some of the workshop teachers have been doing it about 6 months.
Yeah, and that's scary, because, I mean, yeah, they might have locked themselves in a room for 6 months and Wikipedia'd the heck out of their topic, and that's great. And they would probably are going to teach people something. But I guess it depends on, too, and how the way you learn. If you're hands-on, you want to learn from somebody who actually, instead of just is good at talking about it, but actually knows some insight into the topic because, oh, I don't know, they've done it for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, or they make a living actually behind the camera doing it, and they're not just there to sell you a trinket or something to make you magically better, but they need people. I recommend people do their homework and try to get other reviews. I don't even know if there's other, you know, just to get a feedback on other photographers, what they thought of this seminar or
don't pay for a workshop just for the sake of paying for the workshop. Do a paid workshop if there's something really valuable there that you really think you can use and that's relevant.
Exactly. And if the people that are the best at the topic or photography that you're interested in, and they're anywhere near your town, even within a couple states, make the effort to go out there and pay the bigger bucks if they are really worth it. You know, don't just stick to the smaller fish that are going to come into town, you know, in locals, you know, who have had a shingle hung up for a year or two. You know, make an effort to see these great people who are really out there teaching, like Zach Arias and things like that.
There's people that have been in the business for years and years and years, or have done things that are really significant with their work and really are craftsmen at it, and they have a lot to say a lot of times, and they can be really good. But the workshops that most people avoid, you know, I think the workshops most people go to are the quickie sponsored ones. You know, they're like 2 hours long, and they walk away and they're like, oh, it was okay. Well, you get what you pay for. I mean, a 2-hour workshop that had to be paid for with sponsors, and it was just somebody speaking. A real photography workshop, and I shouldn't say that because there's nothing wrong with those workshops. I mean, they can be educational. They're like quick hits. But at the same time,
you get your packet of magic combinations and f-stops, and you feel like you've been, you know, it was a wise $59.99.
And you certainly take tips home from those things. But I think every year, really, a photographer that's serious or professional should have kind of a plan where each year he's going to go to a serious workshop. And yes, it's going to cost hundreds of dollars. And yes, it's probably going to be 2, 3, 4, 5 days. Those kind of things. First of all, typically those kind of workshops are not organized by newbies, although sometimes, but usually the newbie ones are little quick afternoon things and they're hoping to make some quick money. And you can kind of tell if somebody really knows what they're doing. But, you know, find a really good workshop where you know this guy knows what he's doing, and go out there and spend some time and do that once or twice a year, because compared to what we spend on gear and gadgets and stuff like that, that's nothing. And taking a few hundred dollars and going to a week-long workshop, it's incredible how much the lights can start coming on at those kind of things and how much you learn, because you're in a zone of learning instead of in like a 15-minute window of reading a blog.
Sure, and use common sense when you're looking. Some photographers that I absolutely love, I know that there's nothing they could do to teach me what they do. It's inherent. It's them. And there's things that I do that I can teach you the nuts and bolts of what I do to book a client or to get a referral or to shoot a lot of weddings. But again, it comes down to you need to take that and tweak it for what you are and who you are and your strengths. Because really, when it comes down to it, that's really what we're marketing is ourselves. And I don't want to make clones of myself, or I don't want to become a clone of somebody else. So you really need to find out if what you're wanting to learn is even possible to learn from another person.
Right. And there's certainly people that are better at teaching than others. I mean, a really good teacher can – everything's not like learning Lightroom. You know, click here, do this. Learning the craft, you know, the subtle craft of photography, you need to find people that can teach you concepts and subtleties, and you need to be willing to take those and to apply them and to try and figure them out in your own head and how they work to you. Because the really, really good, serious workshops about the technique of photography are not going to be, you know, click here, and click here, and you have a beautiful piece of art, because that's not how it works. I mean, it's one thing, you know, when somebody's telling you how to sharpen in Photoshop, but how to actually make a great photograph is more complicated. But anyway, go out there and learn one way or the other. And even if you can't afford a workshop today, plan it for next year. And in the meantime, start getting some of these books. I mean, sometimes I find photography books, particularly the older ones, on Amazon, and they're like a dollar, you know? I mean, and you can go in. There's so much information to be had out there. Barry, are you still with us?
You bet.
He's just not talking. Any final words, Barry?
Nope, I think we've beaten this horse quite dead.
Yes, it's dead. All right, people, let's wrap up and go home. Let's throw out just a quick pick of the week, some kind of a gadget or a tool or a software. Everybody could throw one out there, like always, and then we will go home. I'm ready for dinner.
I'm playing with the 15-day trial on the software, the Silver Effects for black and white stuff. Really, really, really like it.
Okay, cool. Why?
I like the subtleties of the controls a little bit more than, while I think you can do a lot in, you know, I've a lot of the same things in Lightroom, I like the methodology of how the software is designed. And it just seems like the controls are a little more precise. I like being able to pop around, and I'm just getting a little better at that right now. But being able to identify some of those tonal ranges, it seems like I'm getting closer to a film-like look just playing with that much easier than I've been able to achieve in Lightroom.
Cool. And that's, what is that, about a $200 product somewhere right in there?
I'm afraid to look. I mean, look, I just grabbed the demo because I, after this wedding I just shot this last weekend, I've got some black and white stuff that I want it to be just perfect, and I just wasn't getting quite there in Lightroom yet, so I thought, hey, I'm going to give this a try, and so far I really like it.
Cool. Very cool. And by the way, you can use our promo code PPS with Nick products, and I think that saves you 10, 15%. I think it's 15% promo code PPS. So cool. And Dennis, do you have a pick for us this week?
I have a what's it called, a back, like a pick when someone else already picked it and you just want to say, hey, that was a great pick.
Okay.
What's that called? I forget. What's that word?
A pick refraction.
Oh, that's a lot of syllables. But that's what I want to do. And I think it was Barry maybe who did the on camera hot shoe level.
Yeah.
Is that Barry? Okay.
Yeah.
Plus five on that one. Thank you. And then my other recommendation, that's it, quick hit. And then my other recommendation is actually another podcast that I've gotten a lot of helpful tips and things out of. It's not a photography podcast, but a beep.
Oh, I thought I was going to hear a beep when Gavin edits out the name of the other podcast since we.
And then he covers it up with Pro Photo Show. No.
Okay.
This is it's a podcast called Back to Work on the 5x5 Network. And it deals a lot with mostly productivity and communication and work barriers. Basically, I'm reading it right off of their website here. And it features Merlin Mann, who's been on Mac Break Weekly before and does a whole productivity and GTD type stuff. And Dan Benjamin is the host of the 5x5 shows. Really a great podcast to listen to. I've gotten a lot out of it. You know, it's a good podcast when you find yourself laughing and then taking down quotes of certain things that the people say. Basically, just if you find yourself working, you know, if you're working on your own boss, it's a very helpful podcast to listen to because you find a lot of the, even though it's not specifically related to photography, you can take a lot of what they're talking about and insert, you know, your own business there, whatever your industry you're in, working on your own kind of thing. All kinds of topics all over the board. If you've heard Merlin Mann speak at all, you know he's just kind of random. But I love that style. Big fan. So, yeah, it's Back to Work on the 5x5 Network. And I think you'll enjoy it regardless of if you're a nerd or a jackal. I think you'll get a kick out of it. So check it out.
Very cool. I've got them down, and they will be in the show notes on ProPhotoShow.net. My pick of the week is the Superfoods Indigestion. Oh, wait, no, sorry. That was wrong pick. That was a different show. No, my pick of the week is actually The Eliminator. This really is
this a movie?
Pick.
Is this an 80s
no,
movie? I think I remember that one. Does it have Jean-Claude Van Damme? No?
Watch your language.
I said Van. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Okay. The Eliminator Foggit 700 Fog Machine. This
are you
is
doing
cool.
DJing now?
No. This is photography all the way. Number one.
Halloween is coming.
What's that?
Halloween is coming. You'll be awesome.
Yeah, but it's a write-off. How often do you get to write off Halloween stuff? So this is about $40 on Amazon. It's not a big fog machine, but it's enough for the kind of use. You know, it's not like I use this thing every day. And you just buy fog juice and you plug it in and you let it warm up and you push the button and it goes psh, and it pushes fog out there. Okay. So what I got this for is for a portrait session, and now I'm glad I have it because I can use it for other things. But what we did is it was a senior portrait, and one of our setups was we put the senior in a like a tool shed outside at night, filled the shed with fog so the fog's like coming out, and then put a couple of strobes, one inside the shed and one outside, and had all these different sequences. Some of them were with her kind of walking out of the mist of the fog, some of them with the fog just kind of illuminated behind her and all white. And really made for a pretty cool effect in terms of using light. You know, you fill a room with fog and then put a flash through it, and you got a huge diffuser. So the Eliminator Lightning Foggit 700 is about $40. It's also a fun thing. Me and my son have had a lot of fun. We set it up in the garage, and then we take a laser pointer. And when the garage is full of fog, you can see the beam of your laser pointer, and that's a lot of fun. And it was pretty cool. But if you open the garage door, all that fog pours out the garage door and the neighbors think the house is on fire.
Yeah. The neighbors get nervous when Gavin's playing with his camera gear.
It does look exactly like smoke. Now, if you want it to hover along the floor like they do, like DJs do, you actually have to cool the fog out. You can make like a cooling box. You can buy them or make them out of ice or something like that. I was more just allowing that fog to kind of flow into the air. But this machine, I mean, you can pretty much make a garage foggy in a couple minutes. It'll run for like 60 seconds, and then it has to heat up a little more, and then it'll run again. So a couple of cycles of that, and you've got a lot of quite a bit of fog out there. So it's cool.
Before, I've had those in my cart shopping and then taking them out at the
exactly.
last minute.
You're like, hey, this would be cool. I could use this. And then it's kind of something you put away. So finally I just did it because I had a senior consultation. I'm like, hey, and she wanted to do this or this. And I'm like, well, how about we add fog? So that's usually how I get these kind of obscure gadgets is I actually sell it to somebody first and say, hey, we're going to do this. Then I go and buy it. And it's just not very expensive. I mean, if nothing else, you're going to have a lot of fun with the kids with this thing. You can totally freak out your wife by having the house be on fire when she comes home. And oh, wait, did I say that? And it's just fun. I think there's actually a lot of potential in lighting with something like this. I think we could do some really cool stuff.
Gavin, I thought for sure your pick of the week was going to be a new triple quantity diaper genie since you have a new addition to your house. But congratulations, I should say, in person since I haven't talked to you.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we had a new baby last week, so that means he's like 5 days now, I guess. He's pretty cool, and we're glad it's a boy because he's a lot quieter than our daughter was. I love my daughter, don't get me wrong, but... and hey, real quick, let me put this in the show notes. Did everybody get their pick? I think everybody got a pick.
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't. I'm sorry, Matt. Hey, I'm linking this fog machine in the show notes. Maybe I already linked it. I'm going to put the Pro Photo Show Amazon link in there since we're at it, because if you use that, we get a little kickback for mentioning it. But that's not why I mentioned it. Amazon just has, well, kind of everything. Matt, your pick of the week. Go.
As much as I would love to have my pick of the week be a new Thunderbolt card reader, that doesn't exist yet, so I will save that pick for when it exists. You know what? I'm actually going to pick a book. It's something that helped me out, and it's something I think that's really helpful for people that are new, kind of when they find their passion about something to be able to make a living. And it's a book by Gary Vaynerchuk, and it's called Crush It. And my wife is convinced I love the book because it's exactly how I think. But that's not true. It's just a lot of good information about finding your passion and pushing through it and finding a way to make a living at it and doing what you have to do to live your life through your passion. And it's full of real information, not just platitudes and stories. So I definitely recommend that.
Cool. So it's like a marketing book then, kind of.
I'd say, yeah, definitely more along the lines of marketing, but it's steps on how to take whatever you love to do and make a living at it. A lot of it is through social media, blogging, and things like that, but it's a fascinating book, and it's really entertaining as well. The guy that, if you get the audio version, the author reads it, and he's a hoot, so definitely
cool.
Recommend that.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. Thank you, thank you. And you know what? On that note, I'm going to throw in one more really quick pick. And it's I'll actually put that in the show notes. I'll link it in the chat room here as well. But it's called Hudson River School Masterworks from the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art. And I know that sounds really long and stuffy, but this is early American paintings. And I actually just went to the Seattle Art Museum last week and saw like the Albert Bierenstadt Puget Sound, which is like this 84-inch original painting. Absolutely breathtaking stuff. Which is kind of, one way or the other, I got to figure out how to make my photos presented in that breathtaking of a manner. But if nothing else, this is a really cool book because this looks at, you know, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, the early American art that kind of defined getting people interested in our American landscape and national parks, and it kind of went all along with that. But the cool thing is there's a lot of landscapes. There's a lot of landscapes where there's people in these landscapes. There's a wide variety of in this kind of style, in this category that tends to be called Hudson River School, from these various painters. And you can learn a lot about, you know, light and subtleties and stuff by looking at these. There's a lot of cool stuff in here. And this book is not real cheap. It's a hardcover. It's about $40, so it's a little bit more than the Fog at Eliminator. But it's a beautiful book with some beautiful paintings. And I think we can gain a lot by looking at this stuff. So check that out. It'll be also in the show notes.
And it looks like we have is it Andrew that called in? Andrew has a link for a Thunderbolt card reader. I don't know. I'm still looking to see if it's actually available or if they've just announced it, but maybe we can research it and put it in the show notes if it actually is available for purchase.
Do you have that, Matt? Does Matt want to come on and like review this thing real quick, or does he just find it?
Looks like it'll be out very soon, he said.
Yeah, so it's not. So again, it's among the rest of the products in Thunderbolt land that are non-existent as of yet.
Now, for the people that don't have it, Thunderbolt is like USB, but a lot faster.
It's USB, but they're saying it's faster than USB 3, but it's not just that. It's the speed, it's the connectivity that you'll be able to run anything through it. So it's kind of the combination of very fast as well as you can run anything through it. So I think the only thing that exists right now is maybe a hard drive and a monitor, something like that. So
okay.
Hopefully,
well, I imagine that would that'll change in time as we go forward here. Anyway, guys, okay, I think we've covered it. Very cool stuff. I'm going to do a whole lot of editing on this show, and by the time it hits the feed, it's actually going to have some semblance of professionalism. How's that sound? I think we're good. So let's wrap up for the day. And in closing, I just want to give a quick shout out for our sponsor, SimFX. Check out the new HDR Magic video workshop and the presets and actions and all that kind of stuff. It's a total workflow solution. And helps keep us going around here. And also, don't forget the Lights and Shadows workshop, dynamic range, image quality, HDR, understanding light and working in the camera better. Lights and Shadows workshop is kind of my feature workshop, and that's coming right here in Washington this October. It's 3 days, and simfx.com/LS. And, of course, you can go to simfx.com and just find it there as well. And I'll link it in the show notes. That's the Lights and Shadows workshop coming in October. And with that, let's sign off for the day. Where can they find you? Matt, thank you for joining us, and it's been fun having you. Where can they find you at?
Oh, it's been a blast being with you, Gavin. Let's see, mattshumate.com, mattshumate.com is where my hub, so you can get anywhere from there. My blog is very active. My portfolio in this busy season is very, very not active. But Twitter, I don't use much in the busy season, but Facebook, I'm very active, Facebook/MattShumateFoto.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us. It was cool. Very
Thank
cool
you.
Having you. Yes, always fun to hang out with Matt. Barry, where can they find you?
PicturePlace.com. It all kind of goes from there. We have links to pretty much everything. I've been pretty plucky on my blog in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Cool.
On Twitter, I am fstop95.
Excellent. And what about that super umbrella? Can they buy one of those from you, or what? Have you got that worked out yet?
Still selling a few umbrellas. If anybody wants any information on that, look me up. I'll be happy to give you some information. It's basically a 9-foot huge umbrella with a silver lining, and I use it for some outdoor stuff. It's pretty awesome. Sells for $129.
That's it?
Yes.
Is that handcrafted by Barry?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a bargain. So
Do you have a page for that? You know, you should make a little page for that on your site. I have had people ask about it. They need a destination. You can just put a little PayPal thing up there, and you might start selling so many of them you don't know what to do with the time.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Well, when I'm not shooting four or five sessions a day in teams every day, I will do that. A little busy still right now, Gav.
I hear you. All right, and Dennis, DZPix.com, I think, is where you're at, unless you have a new project you want to shout out to us.
I do not have a new project. Actually, that is where you find me. But if you want to see what I've been up to a little bit here, some good friends of mine started up an airsoft, which is kind of like paintball but with little BBs, YouTube channel. And they're really gaining some momentum and some steam, and they're having fun with it. And I'm usually the guy behind the camera, sometimes in front of the camera. But we're just out there having fun, and this thing's starting to get rolling. So if anybody is into airsoft or just wants to watch some entertaining, somewhat entertaining videos, check out airsofthd.com on YouTube, and the notes
show link will be in the show notes there. So
I'll put a link in the show notes.
I appreciate it.
Yeah,
we all appreciate
it. I've got a friend that's really getting into airsoft. I'm kind of a paintball guy myself, but it looks pretty fun.
Well, as of right now, we're just doing some entertaining unboxings, and then we got some some pretty sweet game footage, cameras that shouldn't be in certain places for some unique vantage points that look really, really sweet. So stay tuned.
All right. Cool. All right, everybody, thank you for tuning in today. Thank you for those of you in the live stream for putting up with all the technical hassles that we had. And I hope you had fun. You can, of course, find me at SIMStudios.com, SEIMStudios.com. I won't rattle off all my other spaces because you can find them all from there, SEIMStudios.com. And, of course, the show notes will be at ProPhotoShow.net, including links to all the stuff we talked about today and a link to the discussion board for this in the forums. And don't forget those forums. Head over to ProPhotoShow.net/forum for the brand new revised Pro Photo Show forums and join the discussion. Lots of learning to be had over there as well. So thank you all for joining us. And with that, we will call it a day and we'll see you all next time. All right, everybody.
Now is a great time to thank the one, the only, Andrew Jones from AWJ Studios. Two shows. He's been our caller to both shows.
Yes, our one caller. And you know what?
Get that man a corn dog or something. I don't
exactly,
know.
Exactly. Andrew, I'm handing you a virtual corn dog.
Wait, Andrew, would you like mustard or ketchup on your virtual corn dog?
That sounds like something people would actually be paying for on Facebook. So-and-so has sent you a virtual corn dog. Remember?
Great, what am I going to... Oh,
don't you love it when they send you gifts on Facebook and they actually paid for them and it's just like an icon that posts to your wall? I love that. Talk about marketing brilliance.
Hey,
I mean,
I just wanted to call and thank you for the virtual corn dog you sent my way in the online. That was very nice. Thank you.
I'm going to have people hire me as a virtual wedding photographer and I won't actually photograph their friend's wedding. I'll just post the thing on their wall. Show the camera icon. You know, Dennis, on a side note, not to go off topic or anything, but the problem I have with airsoft is there seems to be no way to keep, you know, for like validating whether somebody's been hit, which seems like it would be a huge issue.
No, you know when you've been hit. No. You know when you've been hit with one of those things.
I know you know when you've been hit, but it seems like in a competition sense, it'd be really easy for people to cheat.
Yeah, you don't, because if you get hit and you don't call it, they just keep firing on you. It's not, you know, too. You can hear the smack. The smack of a BB on some canvas or, you know, on the gear that we wear, you can hear it quite loud.
Well, it's...
Wait, you actually shoot at each other with... Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just plastic BBs. I don't know.
But they hurt still, which is part of the incentive.
Yes, they hurt, yes. So you know when you've
been hit. Same with paintball.
Yeah.
I guess the reason I'm still favoring paintball... And it seems like paintball, I think, is more expensive. But it's just with paintball, when you get hit, you have paint on you. And there's no – I mean – and you also have a definition point. With airsoft, how do you define – like, what if it just kind of grazes your coat? Is that a hit or it's not? With paintball, it's a strict line. It's not even so much about being dishonest. It's about, you know, if the ball breaks, it's a kill. If the ball doesn't break, you're okay. Or depending on how you set up the rules, which
it
seems like
– It all depends. We play just mostly for fun. There's some people that are very, very, very hardcore. Like ex-military and stuff. But we play mostly for fun on private land. So it's pretty much we just get together 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, something like that. And we just basically call out, you know, say before we even start, we just pretty much say, okay, you know, if you get grazed or a ricochet, obviously those don't count. But if you're hit, because if you are sitting there and getting pelted and you don't say anything, you're going to get just more pelted more and more. And if
you're
going
to have welts on your
oh yeah,
you,
no, you feel it.
You
definitely feel it.
Same with paintball. But that's part of why it's so intense, because it's actually like you're kind of out there hunting each other, but you know nobody's going to die. But at the same time, there is enough pain that it's not like laser tag or something like that where it's like, oh, I've been hit. It's like you genuinely do not want to be hit.
No, yeah, you're getting an adrenaline kick in there.
It gets the adrenaline,
It's fun. It's just, you know, it's like playing sports with the guys. It's just a different form of sports, and we do it very safely and got the eye protection and all the right protection, and then
You do it right, and you're safe about it, and you're responsible. It's a lot of fun.
Now, do you play in public places? Like do you have like gatherings where you like all get together on the courthouse lawn and start shooting at each other with those things?
That's a good way to get shot by real bullets. The guns look a lot more realistic. They don't have like a upside down, what looks like an upside down empty 2-liter thing filled with giant marbles of paint. The guns look very real.
You can tell
a little easier with paintball, but all it is just basically like a flash hider, orange flash hider on the front that gives it away that it's an airsoft gun.
Right. So
you do not display those in public at all.
You don't go running into a police station or into a mall with one of those.
No, Gavin, that's a good way to die. So keep it safe. Keep it responsible.
It's not ideal.
Typically not ideal. Yeah. Thank you, Gavin.
Do not actually try that. I'm just like, I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
There's been some kids that have done some stuff like that in California, and they're actually putting a bill through or trying to get a bill passed that would make all airsoft guns have to be like clear and see-through or hot pink or something.
Dear.
Yeah, and people are so it only takes a few bad apples to ruin it for the rest of us.
Right. Right.
So
exactly.
It's just something fun. But hey, when you're a photographer, when we're a photographer playing airsoft or paintball, you must wear eye protection. Kind of important.
Yeah.
Wear two pairs of goggles.
Those balls are moving. Yeah. You don't want to lose an eye. Not worth it. Wes says that I could always buy colors from Fiverr.
I was going to mention that, but
which is actually a plus one there, buddy.
plus one for Wes.
You know what, Fiverr? I shouldn't blame Fiverr for my interesting experience. If you want to hear about the experience, go to profotoshow.net, and my confession is over there, and it is what it is, you know.
I was actually more surprised that it actually worked.
Well, true. Well, admittedly, like, it was my own vanity, but I also kind of wanted to know, like, is this legit? So, and just to recap for those that didn't, this is all the article, which is meant to be a little humorous, but it's also true, is on Pro Photo Show, and it's me confessing that I paid for Facebook fans. And but it's this Fiverr, and people for $5 can kind of sell whatever they want. They say, hey, I'll do this for $5, and you pay $5 and they do it. So I discovered this morning. I'm like, whoa, this guy says I'll get you 230 Facebook fans for $5, and I'm like, well, okay, yeah, here, like, so I paid my $5, and a couple hours later I had a couple hundred new Facebook fans, and then I started feeling kind of dirty. Yeah. So, and the thing is,
someone did that for $5. Like,
well, here's what I'm guessing. Here's the thing, though. It's not even. It sounds great, and like, this is the thing. Is I already have a page. You know, here's a page. It's not like I have to have fans. I have like a page that has like 1,500 real fans. I mean, I've cultivated these over years. That's my photo page. And so that page is not huge, but it's okay. But I'm like, wow, 200 fans, so for $5. But really all that's happening is these aren't useful fans. All these fans are for is to stroke your ego, because what it is, you look at the people that are actually fans. They have like two friends. They have these weird foreign names. So either this guy has a network of people that is, they all fan each for things, because anybody can fan a page, or he just has like 250 Facebook accounts that are different names, and he just fans you. So the fans, it's like, so as soon as you, it's so non-relevant, and now every time I'll go to my page, I'll be mentally deducting those 250 fans. So it's like I paid for it, and it's not the same. It's not even the same as buying an ad. Actually, I added something to the article today, and at the bottom, that was a little tip, because at the same time, I spent another $5 on a guy that said, I have 4,300 Facebook friends. I will suggest your page for $5. Okay? So I did that one at the same time, which is more different, because it's not this guy, this is like, these are real fans. This guy, I paid him $5 and he did it. And I noticed my page went up by like 30 fans higher when this guy did that. So it wasn't like hundreds. It wasn't huge, but it was $5. And whoever this guy is that had a bunch of friends, he suggested the page, and these people actually went to my page and liked the page. So presumably, and so these people that are coming through, these are actually real users. They actually have friends.
But that's
so they
the
came
same
there.
Thing.
It's not the same thing though.
Those people chose on their own volition to click
like. Yeah, it's very different. It's very different because the second one is more like you just bought an ad. If you buy an ad on Facebook, and people like your page, they may not be the highest quality of your fans, but they may become that because they're going to see your page. If somebody say, if somebody says, it may even be against the Facebook terms for somebody to do this, but if somebody says, hey, for $5, I'll post your page on my wall so other people can see it, is all they're really doing. And then those people then go to your page and say, hey, I want to like this page. This is cool. Those are actually fans. What the other thing was just like for the fans for the sake of having fans that aren't even probably actually real people. Whereas the second one is effectively, you know, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't sell that for $5, but this guy did it. And if you want to buy it, you know, you can choose to do that. I don't still don't know if it's the best idea, but I did both these at the same time. And the second one, I feel like it was way less. But, you know, it's 20 to 30 actual fans to me is better is actually relevant compared to 250 useless fans.
But then again, I would take 5 or 10, you know, real fans. Wait, is
yeah.
That
yeah.
Where are we going with this? It breaks down into, like, you know, the quality versus quantity.
Well,
but
and the quality of fans from ads, I think at least initially, they're always less. You know, they're not as into it. But that's not to say that the thing is with somebody who's actually a real Facebook user that makes the conscious decision to say, hey, I'm going to like this page. They may not know you, but there could be relevance there in the future, and those could actually be useful. This other thing where I just like fell for the bait of like, oh, wow, 200 fans, that's super cool for $5. I got to try that. When the fans are like, nobody's ever actually even going to be seeing anything. All it is like I paid for nothing just to, you know, for the sake of having the fans, and it was stupid. So that's why I confessed.
Well, I think you pointed out in the article, too, that you know, for a brand new business that has 12 likes or something, it might make sense. I mean, as dishonest as it is, for somebody like you, where you're sitting, you know, it doesn't make much of a difference. But I could imagine a photographer starting off with 12 likes that's terrible, and, you know, they do the normal Facebook stuff.
That all you end up with then is a lousy photographer that has, you know, 2,500 likes.
Well,
I see those all the time, and they get them by advertising.
Exactly.
That at least lends some legitimacy to people that aren't paying attention. And I think that's the people they're marketing to anyway. I'm not saying
really
it's a good thing.
Legitimacy, though, or
right.
A false sense of legitimacy?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. What I mean is it lends legitimacy in the eyes of the people who aren't paying attention.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What
well,
I mean.
And I think genuine fans, even if they don't know you at the time they like you, if they actually make the effort to click like and they're a real person, I think that is that's a genuine value.
Yeah.
I think potentially. And now I don't know if this is if this is the best way to get them or not. But really, on the second one, it was not so different. You know, if I pay Facebook to run an ad for me, I'm paying Facebook to shill me to every Facebook user in the world that I'm willing to pay for. So versus paying a guy $5, actually, it was a lot cheaper paying a guy $5 to share my page with his friends than it was getting that many fans from Facebook ads.
Yeah.
So I imagine if that starts happening too much, Facebook will come down on it. Because it would have cost me $100 in Facebook advertising to get that. So I don't know. Maybe that's not such a bad thing. If you have a page where kind of scattered random fans that just might theoretically be interested in what you're doing, particularly for me, I'm thinking, you know, maybe in the future, hey, these might be people that in the future would buy a landscape print. But at the same time, it's still a little shady. I don't know, you know, but the second one I felt was more like an ad. But one of the reasons I posted it, though, was even for the newbie, because I have pages like for mine and my brother's fiction writing. We have some Facebook pages and we have the Writer's Couch website and stuff that we've started. And it's still super tiny. I mean, it's like Pro Photo Show in, you know, 5 years ago. So, you know, I have a desire to move that forward. But after doing it on the, you know, after doing it, there's no gratification in having fans that you know are useless. Even if you paid for fans, if you know there's somebody actually going to be listening to you and watching you, that's different. But if you have a page with 12 people, my advice is don't just buy 250 fans, because at first it's going to be that, you know, yes, it's like, oh, look, I have 250 fans. But every time you look at it, it's going to be like, none of my fans are real. Nobody actually cares.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And in fact, I am a very big proponent of making sure your Facebook followers, fans are getting good content, that they're real people, that they're important, because that's the only way that it has any meaning at all. And although it is tempting, I've been sitting at around 900 for a really long time. Well, not a really long time, but
it's been building up, but not, it'd be nice to get over that 1,000 mark.
It takes a long time. Yeah. And you know what? So, but just don't buy the 200 and, you know, the ones that are promising hundreds of likes, because those likes are going to be useless. You know, if you want to pay $5 for somebody to share your page, I don't have a problem. I think that's okay. But I think the other likes, I mean, I don't think either of them are really morally wrong. The other ones just have no gratification. You just feel like kind of dirty afterwards. Like, I just bought Facebook likes, you know, I just paid for Facebook likes. Okay. Just saying. I've been there, guys.
Matt,
I've been there.
Matt, make that 99 away from 1,000. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Matt, here's what you do. If you really want to get up to that 1,000, run a contest to randomly select one of your people's likes page and give them something.
Oh, once I get closer, I'll do something. Just and really, to be honest, I don't care. It's kind of funny. But once I get close to 1,000, just as an appreciation, I think it's awesome that people pay. I feel completely humble that people pay any attention whatsoever to what I do. So it's awesome.
Yeah, that's actually
a
pretty good page, having that many.
Yeah, no, and it's completely built up based on nothing other than people clicking the button. I haven't advertised it on Facebook or anything like that. It's good and solid. Seth Godin, in one of his books, I want to say it Lynchpin. No, I don't remember. But he, I think it is Lynchpin. He said that the key is 1,000, and he had some study that another author had written about that once you click 1,000 people paying attention to what you do, it's like a siren goes off that it's, you know, you can actually generate more based on that. It's really fascinating. I don't remember the exact information.
Yeah, getting some volume there is good. And what's interesting, it seems like as you get higher, like you get to that 1,000 kind of 1,500 point, and it's really good. And then as you get higher, it's like the response isn't always quite as much as it was, you know, like per capita. It's not as much as when you were at smaller volumes as it grows. It seems to be that way. Same with Twitter accounts. You know, it's not always a one-to-one ratio. Wes says that most of them are fake Facebook forums and they all fan each other. And I would say that's the case. I mean, that's the thing. You get these likes on your pages, but they're pointless likes. So, absolutely.
You've got to always realize too that even though the number says one thing, you really do not have any idea how many of those, like say 1,000, are actually getting your message. Because if you've gone over, you know, posted too many things for their liking, I mean, it could be one a day,
sure,
one a week, one a month. They've hidden you. So that's the one thing.
Well,
that I hear a lot of people who go for this angle, and people who actually are into the social media aspect of photography, and that's all they say is Facebook. But it's like they say, they don't really mention that fact is so true. You really never know how many people are actually getting your message.
Right. Well, and also with the Facebook changes this year, I think Facebook pages in general kind of went down in value because of the way they changed how things show up in feeds and stuff like that. So not that they're not still valuable, but it's even harder. You know, everybody's not always seeing everything you post. So,
sure.
But depending on how their profile is.
Yeah, it's just something to think about. I mean, you may have the best content in the world, but like, I mean, I think I liked a friend or somebody had recommended some other service, and it was like tile, like something to do with floor tiling. And it's like, that's great and everything, but I don't want to have to read, you know, two articles a week on floor tiling. It's just not my thing, you know. I want to support the person, you know, in their business, and I might check in from time to time, but I don't want to get spammed about floor tiling every, you know.
Well, and I think
week.
The case with any of them, though, is spamming. I see pages all the time that are just, I mean, that's all they do is, you know, they think they get a Facebook page, and there's like, Facebook pages are kind of the same thing. Everybody's saying, you know, they go to a workshop or something. It's like, oh, you have to have your Facebook page.
Exactly.
But so they go make a Facebook page, but who I see it really bad is things like restaurants and just businesses. I mean, in the photography community, there's quite a bit of discussion and you have something to actually post because you're taking photos. But in other industries, like their page, all it is like, check out our special this week. Come in this week and buy something. And I'm like, oh, you don't get it. And so there's no interaction on these pages because they're non-relevant to people. And
exactly.
A huge thing with Facebook pages is, I mean, even, you know, okay, you know, maybe you pay for some ads and get some fans, whatever. But at the end of the day, for it to be relevant, you have to produce quality, relevant content. It takes time and cultivation either way. And with that, I just shilled the 10 tips of taming the power of on Pro Photo Show, which is basically
well
everything I've learned about Facebook. And there is actually a lot of little stuff in there. It's a pretty long categorized thing of all these different things I found about getting.
You've been updating that too, haven't you?
Yeah, I updated as things change on Facebook. So that is kind of like the ongoing thing on Pro Photo Show, not only in terms of rules and like things you can and can't do with a page, but also different ways that I find that are actually valid for getting fans. So if you're trying to build your Facebook page, that might be worth checking out. And
awesome.
That's been
anyway.
A great resource for my page.
Good. I'm glad.
I'm posting a link. I think it's from Seth Godin's blog about the 1,000 true fans. And I think it's linking. I didn't go through and
read
it. Yeah,
you have to right-click and copy it. It doesn't click directly.
Yeah.
1,000 true fans.
No, but I think the link, the blog that he's linking to is the kind of the study about the true fans and the 1,000 fans and what it means
gotcha.
And everything.
Okay, there it is.
I just remember it from his book.
Kevin,
so.
Awesome. Check that out. Well, and I think irrelevant of the number, that's the thing, is true fans is what really matters. Getting people, and even if, you know, almost all the fans on like SimFX and all my other pages are actual people that found me one way or another and fanned my page. I've tried Facebook ads and stuff here and there, and I tend to, you know, I always come back to it and say, hey, I'll try it out, check it out, for the listeners, of course, to see if there's, no, but because people do, but it does come up, and so I'm always trying to say, like, is there a way to actually make these work? In my experience, every time I use Facebook pay ads, is that the return is just not what the pay is. I usually try them out it's hard to, I don't know, it's pretty easy to track with something like SimFX where I'm selling presets. So I'll use that a lot and I'll say, hey, I'm going to try, you know, I'll try $100 this week. I just did it like a week ago. I tried another run of Facebook ad and I also tried some AdWords ads. And what I'll do is I'll make a landing page and it'll have a promo code for a deal or something like that. And I get clicks, you know, you pay per click, you end up paying like $1 per click or something like that. But the cool thing about certain things is if you need to set up a way to track it somehow. You need to know, because the result with that is like, okay, I spent $100 and I got, you know, I made 20 or something like that. So it's a no-brainer. I mean, you don't do it anymore. It just, or you change your approach. But I'm not going to keep dumping money into Facebook ads. I don't know. I just feel like, don't most of us ignore Facebook ads? I mean, how often do you really look at a Facebook ad as relevant?
For me, Facebook, the having interaction is far more important than anything else. Interaction is way more important than just having a big number, because that's actually where I've started sending brides when I get inquiries is to Facebook, because there's a lot of interaction from brides that are thrilled with their wedding pictures and the experience, and not just the pictures, because any future bride can go to my websites and see the pictures and, you know, that's it. But really what they're buying isn't just the pictures. It's the overall experience that quote unquote Matt Shoemate Photography offers them. They're buying.
Yeah.
So that's the only way I can actually market that experience part of it. Because that's tough to come across, you know, in an email or something like that. So that's one of the things that
I'm... Actually, that's awesome. I'm glad you said that, because that just kind of, that was like one of the best tips of our entire show. It's simple, but it's like, because what you're doing, if you send everybody there, even people who may not hire you may become a fan of your page and they may hire you down the road. Because I have this thing where, you know, somebody will send me an inquiry and I'm too expensive or this or that or whatever, and then I never hear from them again. But I that's brilliant. I mean, just to say, hey, yeah, glad to hear from you. Check out my Facebook page. And if half of those become fans of your page, even if only 10% of them hire you, you just earn some relevance for down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's
just awesome.
And if they want to dig, because I mean, when I get an inquiry or something like that, I'm digging to make sure that person's not a photographer, you know, that they're a real person. So I'm finding out relevant content about them on Facebook without, you know, before I even send an email back, I'm being able to see that. So if they're the same way, they can go to my Facebook page, they can delve deep and they can find out all kinds of stuff and stories and you know, bride specific things that happened at a wedding that a bride, you know, she had to fit it in two posts because it was so long about how much the pictures meant to her and how it brought back every memory she had of her wedding to
see her pictures once they were posted and,
very cool,
you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that's, or when a bride says that, that the experience that I kept her calm, or I helped her day move along, or I helped deal with some problem she was having. I mean, there's weddings. Last wedding, I taught them how to tie a square knot on the bridesmaids' dresses. I've tied so many ties. Those little things that are far, you know, those, you can't market that. I can't put that on my website and say, here's what else I offer. But when people go see that, those are the things that they can understand that, oh, we're hiring this guy, not just for his pictures, but for everything he does for us, because we're not in a product industry. We're definitely in a service industry, in the wedding industry anyway.
That's cool. Very nice. Well, anyway, I think we've been going very long, and not all this, you know, I'm going to cut most of this out as the after show, but just kind of some good stuff. I may have to get Matt's tip in there. You know, another, you mentioned the length of posts, and I'm sure most people know this, but my little secret for if I post it's too long and I'm like, there's no way I can cut this, you know, 500 words down to 250 characters or however, 400 characters. It really annoys me sometimes, the post length. But if you post a photo with it, there's no limit on post length. So
right.
If you post a photo, the text that goes with the photo has no length limit. So if I get long, I just find a photo that's relevant to go with the post. And
good tip.
I got an idea before we sign
off. Okay.
Something to think about. I'll say it and then we'll sign off. Live
okay.
Show. At WPPI 2012, February. See you there. Maybe?
That would actually be awesome, but I'd need to get some support from WPPI, and at the end of the day, I think I don't know if I have enough cred to get them.
Oh, no. I mean just saying, like, out in the parking lot or lobby, we'll be fine. We can find a place.
I know, but think how much better it would be if we actually got it to be part of WPPI.
Well, if you want to get permission.
No,
just
and then, like, you know,
all
it's,
right.
It's on one of the – but it's a good idea. I like it. See, now you're getting me thinking, though. Okay.
And in fact, we did that, Gavin. We did that last year. I have a Flickr group that is very active, all wedding people. And
right.
We got together, and by far the best part of WPPI was one day we got together and went out into the desert and had a shoot, just photographers taking pictures of each other, trying out stuff. And it was probably out of the entire three or whatever days I was there, that 2 hours was by far the best, and it was awesome. Nothing. It was basically just we were eating dinner and said, "Hey, let's go take some pictures." And
yeah, that's cool.
And it ended up being great.
Well, and even if it wasn't a live show, I'd love to do some more meetups or something like that. I'm not sure if I'll make WPPI in 2012 or not. I am hoping to make Imaging USA in New Orleans, and it'd be really cool to do a meetup or something like that. So that's something I'll work on too. Whether even if it's not a live show, we could have a group get together and have some fun. So. Anyway.
Sounds good.
All right, everybody. Thank you. And everybody have a good day. We'll see you over on the forums.